Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking with Patrick McMahon, president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, ATU Local 85, from Allegheny County, about the latest privatization scheme that our Republicans here in Harrisburg are trying to ram down the throats of second-class county port authorities across the state. Again, another one of these moments where there's an asset. Let's sell it off. Let's hock it off for the cheapest price. See what we can pocket. And, well, who can profit? At the end of it, who gets screwed? You and me. Again, another example. Privatization scheme's going to steal from you and me. When will they stop? Well, they'll stop when you decide that enough is enough and you vote them out, which is what I'm hoping is going to happen in 2012. Also in the third hour, we're going to talk with Doug Cunningham, host of the new radio program, The People's Mic, out in Wisconsin. We're also going to talk to him about the recall of Scott Walker, which tomorrow begins the push to collect signatures and to begin that process. And we're going to talk a little bit about that, some of the shenanigans going on out there in Wisconsin. Also, we're going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Also, remember, check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So, you know, this past weekend, I had a couple of conversations that just stuck in my mind. I couldn't wait to get in here and start talking about it. Because I ran into somebody who, a diehard right-wing talk show host, consumer. This guy listens to every right-wing talk show that's out there, will not think of anything unless it comes from the big lineup. The morning idiot, the afternoon idiot, and the one that follows him, and then all through the night. They all read from pretty much the same script, which is that government's bad, private for-profit corporation, good. Capitalism is the only thing. It's, you know, Tina, baby, there is no alternative. That's what's created all of this. And what I found amazing about the inability to consider an alternative thought, not even a whole world view, just a thought. And what I've been just kind of struggling with lately is this, as we watch Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, because, again, there was another debate this weekend, how nothing the president has done or will do or could do or ever thought of doing could possibly under any circumstances be right. Now, I'm not one of those people. And for folks who've been listening to this program, I'm not an absolutist. I don't look at Obama and the Democrats and say, oh, yes, you're always right. Oh, we love you. No. Anybody who's been listening to this program knows I probably beat up on Obama as much as anybody. But I give him praise when he deserves it. Republicans today seem to be wholly incapable of looking at Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs with any critical thought. Anything that comes out of their mouth that's anti-Obama, they cheer. Well, doesn't matter what it is. Obama loves puppies. Yeah! they go crazy. They don't even know what it is. And I'm looking at this guy, and my head's about to explode because no thought can come in. There's no ability to have dialogue. And one of the things that I've loved about the Occupy movement, even if you're standing in front of somebody looking at them and you're disagreeing, there's still dialogue. And there's still, you know, in all of my experience. Now, I'm sure there are a couple of knotheads there, too, who are not willing to even consider an alternative thought. But the conversation is being had. We're talking about income inequality, to which he thought was just absolute nonsense. Should I make as much as Bill Gates? Well, no. But you should make enough to make a living. And to have that kind of accumulated wealth, that kind of accumulated power, is dangerous to a democracy. It's dangerous. Look at what happened at Penn State. That's the accumulation of power in the hands of a few. We don't want that. And by having this money concentrated, this wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, they're able to dictate beyond what the country is able to do. You know, President Obama was elected in a huge landslide. The will of the people is we want health care. Look at how fast the moneyed interests swung that around. Look at how fast the moneyed interests corrupted the whole system. Because I'm not happy with the health care law either. I look at it as, okay, it's a starting point. Got your foot in the door. Where do we go from here? Which direction? How do we make sure that 50 million people who don't have health insurance today get it? How do we make sure the 100 million who are underinsured, how do we make sure that they don't lose their homes, that they don't lose their jobs, they don't end up in the street homeless? And I think about the guy when I was doing the food drive a couple years ago who came, stayed with us for a week, for the whole week, because he had nowhere else to go because he was homeless. We, the taxpayers, spent a couple $100,000 keeping him alive with various surgeries and drugs and tests and medical treatments and all this stuff. We kept him alive physically through a wonderful medical system that you and I paid for, only to throw him to the street and say, oh, sorry, you're homeless. And there's these two worldviews. There's government should do nothing. And government should do everything. And I got to say, there's got to be somewhere in the middle where government does what we individually cannot. Government is the vehicle for which we change our society that we individually can't. Our friend Joe, who passed away a good day before Christmas a couple years back, the guy who came and stayed with us, I could not financially get him off the streets. Individually, I couldn't change his life. As a society, we have the ability to say, you know what? Nobody should be homeless. Nobody should be sleeping on the street unless they want to. And there are a handful of people who want to be out on the streets. Not many, but unfortunately, they have some mental problems. And we need to get help for them as well. But the individual is never going to change that. And if the churches were the answer, that would have been done. There would have been no need for government intervention. There would have been no need for you and me. But there's this worldview out there that government can do nothing. And there was a moment during the GOP debate on Saturday night from South Carolina that there were a bunch of moments, and we're going to talk about some of those tonight, but there was one with Michelle Bachmann. And she was asked by this National Journal's Major Garrett, if she became president, you know, what would she get rid of? And you kind of go, well, listen to this.
The great society has not worked, and it's put us into the modern welfare state. If you look at China, they don't have food stamps. If you look at China, they're in a very different situation. They save for their own retirement security. They don't have AFDC. They don't have the modern welfare state. And China's growing. And so what I would do is look at the programs that LBJ gave us at the Great Society, and they'd be gone.
Thank you, Congresswoman. Thank you very much.
Think about that for a second. How far have we fallen as a nation when we're talking about emulating China? When we're talking about having the social safety net of the Chinese. Now, never mind what the Great Society was. I mean, there were a lot of great programs, the Civil Rights Act, the War on Poverty, federal aid for public education to make sure that everyone got an education, Medicare, Medicaid, public broadcasting, Department of Transportation, consumer protection. All of these things sprung out of the Great Society to protect people, well, from being screwed, for one, but also from falling into poverty, and it did an amazing job. But if you just set that all aside, never mind that. Her own website, MichelleBachmann.com, she writes, and it's right here, as president, she will ensure that any reform to Social Security or Medicare will only affect those 55 and younger, and she will work to find ways to ease the next generation into a program that is solvent, fiscally responsible, and empowering to the individual. Michelle has also pledged to protect Medicare by repealing Obamacare. But if she's against all of the Great Society, why is she protecting Medicare? And again, you know, I look at this and it just kind of, just makes you go, what are you thinking? Where are you pulling your worldview out of? Where are you pulling these ideas out? Are you reaching behind, getting a good grip and plucking them out? She goes on to say that Obamacare is going to force the military out of their government-funded health systems. She should be against government-run health care. But since it's popular with the military, well, she's got to pander to that and claim that somehow Obamacare is going to ruin it. So she was asked about TRUCARE, which is the military's health care plan. And she asked if her plan would cut into the system. And she said, well, we know the future, Obamacare. It's Obamacare. And quite likely TRICARE, Medicare, and all these will collapse under Obama. And everyone will be put into Obamacare. Not even answering the question. So what does this worldview that she comes from want? Well, what she wants is no safety net at all. She wants a desperation class. They want to undo not only the Great Society, but also the New Deal. You go back and you think of all of the New Deal programs that we benefit from to this day. Think of all the jobs programs, the Civil Works Administration that put people back to work building bridges, put the Civilian Conservation Corps, put, I think, 250,000 people into the conservation tasks and reforestation and all kinds of stuff to help build our park system. The WPA, which I think something like 10 million people had put back to work on construction jobs. A lot of the stuff we still drive over today. And you can go through a whole bunch of the other stuff, the FDIC with Glass-Steagall, the Wagner Act that gave workers the right to collective bargaining. This is all stuff they were against. The Rural Electrification Administration, so that, places like in this area could get electricity, which would have never seen it had it not been by edict, because there was no profit in it. And you could go down the list, Social Security, the Tennessee Valley Authority, the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, all kinds of stuff. All things that Republicans of the day were against. And think about unemployment insurance. One of the first things that FDR did was the Federal Emergency Relief Act. Got aid directly to unemployed workers to stop the free fall. Much like Obama's trying to do. You got to stop the fall before you can build back up. Or you can do the Republican way. Let us collapse. Let the people at the margin, the people who, like you and me, collapse. And then have to pick yourself up back from there. And in the process, what happens, people like Romney come in, swoop up your house for pennies. And then you can buy it back later. But they're against these things. Unemployment. I mean, you look at what's going on here in Pennsylvania. SB 1310. Another handout to the big employers, another handout to the amnesty to the employers who cheat the system. And who gets screwed? You and me. If I were in charge, if I were a representative there over there, I'd be pushing for better benefits. But that's not what we have. What we have are people who want to destroy government, who want to take it down, who want to take our ability to solve our problems and collectively do what we cannot do individually. And I'm telling you, as we go through tonight, there's a bunch of stuff I've got on my mind. And as we move forward, a lot of these privatization schemes just, they're blatantly apparent for what they are. It's a pure and simple theft of what is yours and what is mine to give to them. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. We're going to come back with Patrick McMahon, president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, Local 85. Right back after this. Stick around.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. A new commercial launched on Veterans Day calls on the House of Representatives to vote no on a resolution that could see as many as 120,000 postal workers laid off. The Postal Workers and Mail Handlers Union launched the ad to bring attention to the fact that the U.S. Postal Service employs more veterans than any other civilian employer. According to the organization, as many as 26,000 veterans could be put out of work if the legislation passes in the House. In addition to the layoffs, that plan also calls for an end to Saturday deliveries and the shuttering of thousands of post offices around the country. A second plan introduced in the Senate doesn't end Saturday deliveries and seeks to buffer the layoffs with buyouts. Under the Senate plan, the Office of Personnel Management would be authorized to repay the Postal Service for $7 billion in overpayments made to the employee retirement system. $2 billion of that would be used to encourage employees to take early retirement, and if 100,000 employees do so, the Postmaster General believes it could save the service as much as $8 billion per year. A union-affiliated finance and investment company is joining the American Federation of Teachers to invest in Oregon public schools. Doug Cunningham has more on the story.
Ulico, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company, says it will collaborate with government, unions, and businesses to invest up to $15 million in Oregon schools that include low-cost energy retrofits. Ulico CEO Edward M. Smith says Ulico is committed to providing specialty insurance and investment products to meet the needs of working men and women, as it has since its founding in 1927. AFL-CIO Building and Construction Trades President Mark Ayers says these kinds of investments are invaluable to members of the building trades who are grateful for the chance to strengthen communities where they live and work. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten, meanwhile, says that she's gratified by this investment because it will help ensure children have access to facilities which help them reach their full potential. This $15 million Oregon Public Schools investment is part of a broad commitment to action by a number of unions and investors through a Clinton Global initiative earlier this year. Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You know, you go back to the New Deal era, and there was some really enormous investments in our infrastructure, enormous investment in people and in our society. And it was really an actual plan with smart policies and sound investment that paved the way for the largest, most prosperous middle class in the history of the world. Now, the right will tell you, well, that's the wonders of capitalism. But did we have pure capitalism then? No, we had a very regulated form. We encouraged competition. We encouraged hard work. But we also rewarded those things. You go back and you think about how we built that middle class, how my grandfather's generation, the World War II generation, how they built the most prosperous, the largest middle class in the history of civilization. And then you go back and you go, who stood up against it? Who were those who stood against all of the policies that I talked about? The Wagner Act, giving people the ability to form and join unions. Social Security, you know, all of the programs that we kind of take for granted today. Because they just make sense. Well, it's the same people we see lining up against any investment or smart policy today. It's the privateers. It's the profiteers. You know, they say if there's a public asset that they can profit from, today's Republican Party, man, they're throwing it up on the auction block. And the question is who loses? Well, you and I lose. Because now you're no longer getting a service. And if you are getting that service, you're paying through the nose for it. And I look at another privatization scheme going on, and it's going on out in Pittsburgh. They want to sell off the second-class county port authorities. Allegheny County, the Port Authority, they want to hock it off. And we were supposed to talk with Patrick McMahon, president of the Amalgamated Transit Union. We're still working on it. Maybe we'll get to him a little later. But, you know, you go to their website, atu85.org, and they got pictures on there of the old trolleys. And they look like they're maybe from the late 40s, early 50s, part of the smart investment of the New Deal. Part of building infrastructure. And they got these trolley cars that are running around. When I lived in Cleveland, you know, back in the day, my grandmother used to talk about how they'd get downtown and how they'd move around. And there were these trolley cars. And if you go back and you learn the history of what happened to those, they were privatized. They were auctioned off. And you had these for-profit companies going, well, we're going to make a profit from this. What used to be part of the common good, what used to be, hey, we need to get people from point A to point B for the public good, became a profit motive. And, of course, fares started going up and ridership went down, so fares had to keep going up and ridership went down. And then they stopped investing. They stopped fixing things. They stopped fixing track and cars. And what happened? Eventually, it all just crumbled. And the auto industry was all too happy to help hurry along that process of destroying public transportation so that people would have to buy cars. That's how we got to this point. While Europe was going, you know what, we need to make sure that all our people can get to work and get around, and they built a world-class transit system, we chose to go the opposite route. All of that investment we put in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, we allowed to decay and crumble and do away with. And it's part of this whole Grover Norquist starve the beast mentality. It's part of this whole,
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You know, you look at this. What's going on with this House Bill 10? And what they want to do is they want to auction off the profitable parts of it. If there's a profitable line, and they've already done a portion of this, if there's a profitable line, they want to hock it off. So the state gets a little bit of money and they can look good by not having to raise taxes, even though they've sold our future out. And then this for-profit company goes, oh, we got the most profitable line. We're going to make a whole bunch of money. At whose expense? Well, the taxpayers. Because then what happens? Well, they start raising the prices on the profitable lines. Those people go to a different terminal, start using the public part. And now what happens? Now they want to privatize the whole thing. And you watch. In a couple of years, if they do this, they're going to come back and ask for subsidies because, oh, we just can't operate. And then they're going to come like private for-profit corporations do. They come with their hand out. You know, I've talked about this before. I remember when I was a kid. You know, I lived in a housing project in a really crummy part of town. But you know what we had? We still had access to parks. We still had access to a swimming pool that, you know, had glass in it a lot of times, and it wasn't in the greatest of repair, but it was still there. There was public investment that at that point of the 70s was already being starved. Now what do you got? I want to take my kids to the pool. I think it's $24 every time I want to go now. Conservative world is all about you reaching into your pocket for everything that you do. There's nothing that we can do as a society. There's nothing that we can do as a community in their mind. It all has to be for-profit, private interests. Now, I know, this is another one of those I got from the guy this weekend. Well, you're talking about socialism. We got a lot of socialism in this country. We just don't like to admit it. Social Security, well, to a degree, yeah, absolutely. As soon as you put two people into a pool, as soon as an insurance company started, that's really kind of socializing because you're socializing the risk. We're all in this together. You know, I guess the question then becomes, what kind of a society are we? Are we a society of a bunch of cowboys like George Bush running around going, hooray for me and screw everybody else, and I'm going to run over your foot and I'm going to shoot up things? Or are we a society of astronauts where we're all in this confined area? We're all in this country, and how do we utilize our assets? How do we utilize our people? How do we utilize the space to benefit everyone and give everyone an opportunity? I'm not talking about making sure everyone's equal. I'm talking about giving everyone an opportunity. And the right has, you know, kind of taken on to this, well, you know, income inequality. They want everyone to be equal. It's not what I'm saying. And I don't think that's what the folks who are complaining about income inequality are saying. What they are saying is you've got a handful of people who are benefiting wildly. And they are getting too powerful. I look at the Koch brothers, getting too powerful. When you can negotiate having say of major universities in this country, if you can have sway over those major universities on who they hire to be part of their faculty, who they put on as an economics professor, I think we have too much power. And you look at this thing, and when we come back in a bit, you look at this thing with Penn State. This is the accumulation of power. This is power run amok. And even my most ardent Tea Party friends, even the most far out on the fringe, cannot look at today's society and go, we encourage a handful of ultra wealthy, ultra powerful people to dictate what happens. Which is why I find it absolutely amazing that they will defend the Koch brothers, because of course the Koch brothers are funding the Tea Party. As Mitt Romney said, they're the engine of the Tea Party. They're the money behind the whole movement. They're the ones who are propping it up. They're the ones who make sure that all the permits are paid for and the skullcrackers don't come in. But what I'm amazed at is why my Tea Party friends, why they're not looking at this mass accumulation in the hands of so few as a danger to that precious document that they so claim to love, as a danger of our law that some people are above the law. I'm of the mindset nobody should be above the law and everything should be in the open and transparent. And you look at our election laws, nothing about it is transparent. I don't know who's funding this ad or that ad. And you wait till this 2012 election ramps up, because we're already seeing money being spent. You wait till this election ramps up. And I'm hoping that people get so frustrated and so angry that there's a major pushback. So when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the Paterno thing, because you know, a couple of new little twists, I'm sure we've got to talk about it. And a couple other things. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Stick around. Right back after this.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Here's a surprise that the power elites really hate. Many members of the 1% are joining the We Are the 99% protest movement. I don't mean that hedge fund billionaires are suddenly in the streets to show solidarity with millions of Americans who are fed up with the systemic inequality and corruption infesting our economic and political systems. No, no, those swells aren't about to dirty their Gucci's with any street action. Rather, I'm talking about another extra special 1% of our society, the soldiers who've been the boots on the ground in Washington's misguided and bloody wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Rather than marching in Veterans Day parades this year, thousands of vets from America's abused war class have been rallying with the Occupy movement. They're expressing their anger at being used in two senseless wars that enriched corporate contractors while the troops who are lucky enough to make it home alive can't find decent jobs and are shorted on the health and education programs they desperately need. In New York, more than 100 of our nation's soldiers proceeded in uniform from the Vietnam Vets Plaza to Wall Street, where they stood in formation in front of the stock exchange. Corporate profits on the rise, they chanted. Soldiers have to bleed and die. The powers that be, far from offering the salutes that vets deserve, much less offering the help they've earned, deployed a line of New York police to block these peaceful protesters from the financial manipulators inside and another line of police on horseback wielding nightsticks to threaten them. This is Jim Hightower saying this was a disgraceful show of force against those who have fought our wars. The police should be looking inside the financial empires, not threatening protesters. But their action exposes just how perverted and corrupt the power elites have become, and why all of us should support this burgeoning democracy movement.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thoughts are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
You want the witness of change in the counteract? We gotta take the power back.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download our podcast there. Or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, and you can take the program on the go. So, over the weekend, Governor Tom Corbett was on with Meet the Depressed, and he, big prediction. He said, if I'm to speculate, I wouldn't be surprised if we had more victims come forward. I'm almost going to guarantee that. At some point, there will be more people, just not yet. Because, look, at the end of this, what's going on? The outcry, and I got to be honest, there's part of me that's absolutely disgraced by what I saw happen in the direct aftermath of the Paterno firing. And I understand, look, the guy's a beloved character, but at the end of this, I'm going to agree with Corbett, who said, they may have done the minimum. They may have met their minimum obligation by reporting it up to the next level, but they didn't, in his opinion and in mine, meet their moral obligation. And I'm actually going to agree with Corbett on something here, which is pretty remarkable. But I do believe they had the responsibility to do more. And especially this McQuarrie, I cannot imagine. I cannot fathom walking into a situation like that and not doing something. Slamming a locker, coughing, anything, but to stop it. I saw a report that McQuarrie is, it's being reported he has hired a lawyer. The reports are that the lawyer is an employment lawyer, so I'm assuming he's going to seek some sort of whistleblower protection and try not to get fired, maybe seek a sizable settlement since I have to think he's, for all intent and purposes, unemployable. I don't know of anybody who's going to, with the problems that come around, are going to employ this guy. So he's going to have to do something. And this whole thing just stinks all the way around. And the more you look at it, the more you go, this is what happens when you put too much power in the hands of a few people. I mean, Paterno was looked at as a god. And look at how far he's fallen in people's opinions. I mean, now the day after being the armchair quarterback, are you going to, would you give him that kind of status? You know, I was thinking about this Jerry Sandusky. And I keep thinking about my kids. And story after story, these kids that the parents let sleep over at his house. You know, go back to the Michael Jackson stuff. Who in their right mind lets their kids sleep over someone's house who's an adult? Who in their right mind? You know, my daughter sleeps over at her best friend's house. They're classmates every once in a while. They have sleepovers. And they come and they stay at our house. I guess that's okay because, you know, they're both there. I still have some reservations. As I'm sure that, you know, my daughter's friend's parents have some reservations. But no way in a cold day in Haiti do I say, here's my 9, 10, 12-year-old son. Please, Mr. 60-year-old, let him sleep at your house. No way in hell does that happen. And why did it happen in these cases? Because we put these people up on pedestals. We sat this guy up on the top of the mountain and said, oh, yeah, he's a good guy. And then when they found out, they slowly pulled back. And the university said no more. Yeah, we're not gonna let you come around anymore. And you look at this accumulation of power. And I look at the Citadel, a major, extremely highly acclaimed military college. Evidently, this weekend, they said, well, you know what? We had a scandal ourselves. They had a counselor at the military school who, a couple years ago, had the accusations of some inappropriate conduct that they, you know, they kind of looked into, and then they got, you know, kind of pushed him along, you know, just push him along, let someone else deal with him. He's recently been arrested for child molestation charges somewhere else. At another school, at the Coastal Christian Preparatory School, where he had coached for several years. And I think about, you know, these coaches, you know, that what is this doing to all of that? And it's this power that we give these people. It's scary stuff. So, of course, out of all of this, what comes out of it? Well, then the anti-gay people. The haters come out, the Santorum types of the world. And the questions start popping up. Should gays and lesbians be qualified to adopt children? Should we allow them around children? Should they be allowed to be teachers? So I've been hearing this stuff as well, which, again, serves their narrow-minded, simplistic worldview. The reality is Sandusky and this guy at the Citadel, these are child predators. These are not homosexuals. These are child predators. And in Sandusky's case, had a wife and kids. But they're going to use it, and they're going to try and spin it in their own way to make that allegation, well, all gay people are this way. And they're not. But they're going to use it for their purposes. And I think about this charity, this Second Mile. And there's part of me that wants to believe that it was started for good, noble, altruistic reasons that, you know, they had the interest, at least at the beginning, maybe they had the interests of these kids at heart, and it wasn't started just as a an opportunity center for Sandusky. And I want to believe that, but it's hard. I mean, especially since you see now the guy who was the head of the head guy there, who has just resigned. I guess he was the CEO for nearly 30 years, this Jack Rakovitz. When they were told a couple years back, why didn't they get rid of him? Well, because this guy was on the pedestal. He was bringing money in. And what's frustrating to me on so many levels is I go back to my own experiences. When I was a kid, my mother signed me up with Catholic Big Brothers and Big Sisters. And I met the most incredible human being probably to ever be born. I'm sure right now he's walking side by side with Jesus Christ himself. Because this 60-year-old guy came into my neighborhood every Saturday to spend time with this 7-year-old kid all the way up until I was 14 when he passed away. But every Saturday he was there. And, you know, I go back and then you start thinking, well, you know, hey, the time he patted me on the shoulder, was that something? That's the problem with things like this happening. It casts a shadow on everything. And it's a damn shame. And what's really a shame is it was allowed to happen for so long. Yeah, I remember my big brother. He was, like I said, he came into I lived in a predominantly African-American neighborhood, one of the few white kids in the neighborhood. And this guy fearlessly came into my neighborhood week after week after week to give me the guidance and the vision that there is something out there beyond the poverty. There is opportunity out there. And I credit him with where I am today, as I hope more volunteers and mentors do. Yeah, I think back to the time when, for 10 years I volunteered as a big brother. And I hope that kid sees the time that we spent together as a value and as a way to see something different. I mean, I look at this and it's an absolute shame. It's an absolute shame that this has been allowed to go on for so long and that there are people who are actually defending the guy. I mean, they're actually sending him money for his legal defense fund. I mean, that is mind-blowing to me. But I guess, it comes down to that you are, in this country, after all, innocent until proven guilty. And I want to believe in that. But sometimes it's tough. And I also think, how's this guy going to get a fair trial? How's this guy going to get a jury who doesn't know absolutely everything before they sit in the jury box? I mean, are they going to find someone, in an underground bunker somewhere? Maybe in Dick Cheney's bunker? There's part of me that hopes they come up with an agreement and he goes away and this whole thing diffuses. But we learn the lessons. And the lesson in all of this, again, comes back to this power that we entrust in the hands of a few, be it over children, be it over our economy, be it over our society, this power that we entrust with just those few hands. That's what's worrisome to me. Let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Dear John Bank, I am so sorry it has to be this way, but there's just no choice. I wish circumstances were different, but I can't hide my feelings any longer. I'm in love with another, and you just don't compare. I got tired of you taking advantage of me, charging me higher and higher fees, and raising rates behind my back. I did love you so. But now we have to break up. It's hard, but the right thing for me. I'm with PSECU now, and this credit union treats me right. That's all I ever asked for, to be somewhere I belong.
If you're ready to break up with your bank and take back what's yours, we're ready to help. Call, click, or come in. You can join. Go to psecu.com/befree and see where you belong.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone, by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make headway to happen!
Not right-wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
What they do?
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. Salon.com has a report over there talking about the new Bill O'Reilly book. And it reports that the Ray Emerson, he's the deputy superintendent for the official National Park Service bookstore at Ford's Theater. He has recommended that Bill O'Reilly's best-selling book, The Lincoln Assassination, not be sold at Ford's Theater. And why? Why? Because he just doesn't like Bill O'Reilly, right? He must be one of those flaming liberals. Well, he says it's because of the lack of documentation and the factual errors within the publication. And I think about this and I go, well, you just make stuff up. What the heck? But O'Reilly said that he didn't want to just write another boring history book. So he just made a bunch of stuff up. Spice it up a little bit. Some shootouts, some, you know, maybe somebody ringing bells, you know, all kind of stuff. Women in bikinis, you know, all kind of stuff. And this is what happens when you have a pundit writing about history. This is what happens when you entrust your research to someone like O'Reilly or someone like Glenn Beck. They start off with a point of view. And it's kind of amazing to me. But yeah, they won't even consider putting it on the shelves because, well, it's got a whole bunch of troubles. But you know, and would you expect anything different? I know I don't. Let's go to the phone lines. I got Stosh on line one. How you doing tonight, Stosh?
Hey, Rick, what's going on, man?
It's another day in paradise, brother.
I'm going to talk about Joe Paterno.
Go ahead.
He should be stripped from the day that he realized there was something going on wrong in his organization. Like they stripped Pete Rose, like they stripped Marion Jones, like they stripped Reggie Bush, like they stripped O.J. Simpson of all their awards. He should be stripped of all the wins from that point on. Up until now, from all the wins that were, you know, counted towards his heroic overtaking of the black coach from Grambling.
Eddie Robinson.
Yes.
Well, here's what they did do. The Big Ten has taken his name off of the championship trophy. It was supposed to be called the Stagg Paterno Trophy. It is now just going to be the Amos Alonzo Stagg Trophy. So they have taken that away. They've taken his name off that. And the other part of it is this past Saturday, had he coached that one game, would have put him in the history books again for having coached the most games, one ahead of Amos Alonzo Stagg. I think it's 549 is where they both stand. So I mean, there is some There's a little bit. It's not as far as you're going, but there's a little bit there. And here's my personal thought on this. I think you've now taken everything that this guy has in life away from him. And I hate to say this, but I think 6-7 months down the line, we could see Joe passing on, which would be just a horrible tragedy. But you know, you've now taken this man's life. When he wakes up every morning, you've taken that. They've taken it away from him. Rightfully so. Rightfully so.
How many kids' life did he take? He had a chance to stop this madness.
I agree.
Being done to all these kids through all these years, who are now in their 20s and 30s and having problems mentally, can't deal with it, and his man's still walking around. I have no soft spot for him.
No, I don't either, but I'm just saying, at this juncture, now you've taken his reason to wake up in the morning away. And, you know, when I know I've had friends who, once they retired, they sat down, and then a couple months down the road, that was the end for them. Sad. This whole situation is just a tragedy. Start the front.
I'm in favor of taking all those games from that point on back off his record. So, I have no sympathy whatsoever for all those kids who have nightmares now, who are out doing crimes now because didn't do the right thing.
I hear you. No disagreement here, Stosh. And I think the legislation we're seeing going through the House here, we talked to Kevin Boyle last week. There are a couple other pieces going through, making it a felony for not reporting, which I got to be honest, I thought it had been. I thought you had to report it to police, but evidently coaches are excluded. Teachers have to. Coaches don't. They just had to report it up.
Mm-hmm. And today I made the last transfer out of the big bank.
All right.
And this is what this woman did to me. She asked me, why are you taking money out? I said, it's part of the Occupy Wall Street program that I'm doing my bit. So it was near lunch period, right?
Yeah.
So she did all the paperwork, got everything up. She said, I'm going to get your money. She went and took her lunch break and had me sitting there the whole time she was in her lunch break. And one of the other people that worked there came out and said, she's taking a lunch break. She just wants you to know that she's taking a lunch break. I said, I want to say it on the radio.
I hear you.
I said, this is why people are fed up with this kind of stuff, the way you treat them. I had to sit there a half hour. All she had to do was bring me did all the paperwork. All she had to do was bring me my cash.
Wow.
Took her a half hour while she went and ate her lunch. As form of punishment to me for taking my money out of Wells Fargo.
Good for you. Good for you. And that's when I would have called her manager and I'd have said something.
So that's why people are leaving. I should have, but I was too. I was too pissed. I might be in jail. I'd be in jail right about now.
Yeah, we don't want to do that. But good on you. Good on you for moving your money. You know, and that's what it's going to take. It's going to take people voting like you, voting with their feet, Stosh.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate the call, brother. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Good. I'm glad to see people moving their money out of the big banks and into the credit unions and small local bankers. Good for him. I got an email during the break from Ron. He writes, in the mid-70s, I worked for an architectural firm where a lot of work we did was to design apartments for the Farmers Home Administration. These units were built in small rural communities to provide housing for underprivileged working poor. These projects provided work for architectural firms, contractors, subcontractors of all sorts, as well as providing basic housing for people who could not afford market rate housing. This all went away. Guess when? During the Reagan administration, he writes, they instead started giving out what? Housing vouchers. The result, of course, was a plethora of vouchers, an excess of vouchers, and a shortage of housing. If these housing programs could be restarted, the stimulation would help construction. It would be profound. Housing vouchers are a concrete example of the failure of supply-side economics. I couldn't agree more. I mean, the reality is, it's the same argument they're making for education vouchers. Vouchers across the board. I mean, Mitt Romney wants vouchers for the military guys coming back to buy health care with. It's this whole replacing something tangible with here, go see what you can get with this. Knowing that you're not going to get anything with this. It's the whole way that they destroy all of these programs. And, you know, the housing thing is another example. And I remember this. And where I grew up, of course, was one of those places that they built up, you know, during the, just before World War II to subsidize housing. To get people to work. Our problem in this country is we've got so many big monstrosities, nobody can afford them. But excellent email. And, of course, if you want to email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, I do answer all emails personally. And I go back to the Reagan administration. A lot of the massive changes that are still with us happened during that period. Because the same people who wanted to destroy the New Deal were still working to destroy the New Deal. And they had someone that they could control, someone who was pliable. And for as much as we want to think Reagan was, this great communicator and he had this great vision, not so much. He was very pliable. And this is another example. And I as long as I live to the day I die, I will never forget ketchup as a vegetable. I will never forget changing the school lunch programs that said, we're going to put broccoli on a plate. We're going to change broccoli with ketchup. Because now ketchup evidently is a vegetable, according to them. How did we get here? I mean, really, how screwed up have things gotten? I mean, just in my lifetime, where there were jobs to be had. You know, I go back and I think of all the conversations I had with my grandfather, who talked about a prosperous economy. And our problem right now is our trade policies. It's our massive trade deficits. It's the fact that we're still pursuing these bizarre ideas that we can have an open, intertwined world and that we're all going to play by the same rules and we're all going to be fair. And it doesn't work that way. You know, I remember Rodney Dangerfield. Look out for number one, but don't step in number two. We've been crawling in number two. And it's all so that we can feed our investor class. It's all so we can feed the wealth class. Because these trade deals, they were never about you and me. These policies that they push forward, it's not about helping us. It's about rewarding the top while punishing the bottom. And keeping the bottom just happy enough that they don't revolt. And you look around the country, all of these educated kids out in the streets, all these educated people who can't find jobs, saying something's got to give. This has got to scare the hell out of the investor class. It absolutely has to. And when we come back, we're going to talk about, look, the Republican Party, when I was a kid going through high school, my government teacher said flat out, the Republican Party is the party of the investor class. They are the party of the wealthy. Their policies, their thoughts, their ideas benefit the wealth class. The Democrats, they're the ones for the poor. The idea is, how do you find that balance in the middle that pulls everybody together? How do you have that strong, large middle class? And you do that, through policies that reward work. That's how you do it. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this.
Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to Win,
the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. A new commercial launched on Veterans Day calls on the House of Representatives to vote no on a resolution that could see as many as 120,000 postal workers laid off. The Postal Workers and Mail Handlers Union launched the ad to bring attention to the fact that the U.S. Postal Service employs more veterans than any other civilian employer. According to the organization, as many as 26,000 veterans could be put out of work if the legislation passes in the House. In addition to the layoffs, that plan also calls for an end to Saturday deliveries and the shuttering of thousands of post offices around the country. A second plan introduced in the Senate doesn't end Saturday deliveries and seeks to buffer the layoffs with buyouts. Under the Senate plan, the Office of Personnel Management would be authorized to repay the Postal Service for $7 billion in overpayments made to the employee retirement system. $2 billion of that would be used to encourage employees to take early retirement, and if 100,000 employees do so, the Postmaster General believes it could save the service as much as $8 billion per year. A union-affiliated finance and investment company is joining the American Federation of Teachers to invest in Oregon public schools. Doug Cunningham has more on the story.
ULICO, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company, says it will collaborate with government, unions, and businesses to invest up to $15 million in Oregon schools that include low-cost energy retrofits. ULICO CEO Edward M. Smith says ULICO is committed to providing specialty insurance and investment products to meet the needs of working men and women, as it has since its founding in 1927. AFL-CIO Building and Construction Trades President Mark Ayers says these kinds of investments are invaluable to members of the building trades who are grateful for the chance to strengthen communities where they live and work. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten, meanwhile, says that she's gratified by this investment because it will help ensure children have access to facilities which help them reach their full potential. This $15 million Oregon Public Schools investment is part of a broad commitment to action by a number of unions and investors through a Clinton Global initiative earlier this year. Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Time will change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So this Reince Priebus, who is the chairman of the Republican National Committee, he was on Candy Crowley's program on CNN. And he was talking about a new New York Times poll that found 69% of the nation believe Republicans in Congress favored the rich, while only 9% thought that their policies favored the middle class. And a mere 2% thought that Republicans gave a rat's behind about the poor. We know that that's not the case. But, you know, Reince had to get out there and he had to, you know, oh, no, it's certainly not true. Name me one policy that the Republicans have put forward, just one thing, that they've done that has benefited the working class of this country solely. You know, every time we raise the minimum wage, you've got Republicans pushing, oh, we need tax breaks for big corporations. We need handouts. Every time we talk about improving the lot of the middle class, improving the lot of the lower working class, it's always, well, what's in it for the top? He goes on to say, I think it's a red herring, and I think that the president is doing a full-time job of trying to play the game of class warfare. Really? Do you really think that this president Now, look, I like the guy on a personal level. Some of his policies, well, I got a real problem with. I don't see him as a class warrior. I'm missing that. The reality is what you've got is you've got a party who wants to do away with Medicare, wants to do away with Medicaid, wants to kill Social Security, wants to strip the social safety net. Michelle Bachmann herself said, I want to be like China!
The Great Society has not worked, and it's put us into the modern welfare state. If you look at China, they don't have food stamps.
No.
If you look at China, they're in a very different situation. They save for their own retirement security. They don't have AFDC. They don't have the modern welfare state, and China's growing. And so what I would do is look at the programs that LBJ gave us at the Great Society, and they'd be gone.
Thank you, Congressman.
All of them
Thank
gone.
You very much.
All of that stuff gone. So you got the Republican Party who say, well, no, we're not the party of the very wealthy. We just want to get rid of all that stuff that helps those poor people. And I get this email, and I get it every couple of months. Someone sends it by to me with the idea that, you know, if as soon as the poor people realize that they can vote themselves untold treasures, the democracy will fail. And I'm going, well, where are you seeing this? Where am I seeing these generous benefits? Where's this stuff coming from? Every time we look for an increase in the minimum wage, it's always to keep up with what was lost. It's never to say, how do we get ahead of the curve? I would have said the last time we increased the minimum wage, index it for inflation. So that every time inflation goes up, the minimum wage goes up. So minimum wage is at least that, the minimum. But you got these folks, man, they do a great job of spinning, putting a little kernel of truth in with things and just spinning the hell out of it. And how many times have you heard, well, if we increase the minimum wage, why don't we just raise it to $100 an hour? I mean, ludicrous, preposterous, ignorant, dumb statements. And you look at this and you go, how can you make the argument that they're not the party of the wealth class? When everything that comes out from them is how do we protect them? We're not going to raise taxes on the wealthy. They have staked the entire country's well-being on the fact that they are not, come hell or high water, no way under a cold day in Hades, they are no way going to raise taxes on the wealth class. No way, no how. It's not going to happen. So are you surprised? And the answer is no. And you'll get Reince Priebus, the guy from Wisconsin. Funded fully by the wealth class. And understand, when the recall starts tomorrow, when they start collecting petitions for the recall, he's going to be behind a huge effort to not only delay, stall, and make the recall not happen, but he's also going to be behind a treasure trove of cash to make sure that Walker has all the money he could possibly ever need. Someone told me that this governor's race could bring in some $60 to $70 million because there is no cap. There's nothing. And you're telling me we don't have a problem with how we finance our elections? So you look at all the things that have been going on. And Republican controlled legislatures with Republican governors, all of the states that have gone after this photo voter ID because, oh, there's this big fraud out there. Oh, it's a huge fraud. You know, those four cases over the last decade, that's just a massive fraud that we need to stop immediately. You know, those four instances, and they're not even sure that they were intended, but you know, we found four of them. The people over at Politiscope came up with an interesting Facebook page that they, again, you know, you look at this and you go, really, this is what people are saying they're going to do? A guy named Charles Atlas Shrugging. That's real creative, don't you think? What do you expect from a right winger? He says, I'd like to collect signatures of those who want to recall Walker so I can feed something to my shredder. Because it's kind of hungry, you know. That, my friends, that is voter fraud. That is a crime. His buddy says, I shall be heating my home with recall signatures. As they sign, I will tell them to make sure not to sign another petition. I figure I can get a few hundred to several thousand signatures off the ballot. F you, liberals. Another guy says, well, you know, the birdcages of real citizens of Wisconsin will be lined for months. Again, maybe I'm missing something here. But the idea of our ballot being sacred, the idea of having a voice in our democracy, and having people like this saying, I'm going to shred it, I'm going to burn it, I'm going to line the birdcage with it. And there are a whole bunch of other people who have said similar things on this. Now, look, they're just statements. But it does bring into the mind, how many people are actually going to do this? How many shenanigans are going to go on? You know, one of the ones I loved in Ohio, they had a flyer going around that said, oh, election day is on Wednesday this year. It's a special election. We moved it to Wednesday. Yeah, one place was running a radio ad, building a better Ohio. They were running a radio ad saying, oh, you know, tomorrow's election day. On election day, they were running the robocalls. But, of course, it was just an honest mistake. Could have happened to anyone. Why isn't that a crime? Why aren't we going after that? Because it's only those voters. Personally, I think we should have same-day registration everywhere. I don't care whether you registered to vote a month, six, ten. If you're an American citizen, you have the right to that ballot box. And we as a nation should be demanding same-day voter registration. But what are Republicans doing? Everything they can do to make that harder for you to access. I mean, look what happened up in Maine. They tried to get it off the ballot. It's nuts. But we put up with it. And why do we put up with it? Got an email during the break from Andy. He writes, I love it. This is part of the Occupy Wall Street program. That's great. Yeah, stosh. Just part of the program. The comment of the week award goes to stosh. Hit him in the pocketbook. That's wonderful. Hit him in the pocketbook. And the plutocrats will take notice. If everyone took their money out of the big banks, we'd go a long way in taking the wind out of the Wall Street's power. No deposits, then no money to speculate with on commodities that working people depend on, and cut some of the lobbying money used to grease the skids of the politicians. I agree with you, Andy, and thanks for the email. Again, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. And, you know, look, that's why I'm against too big to anything. I'm in favor of smaller local. I'm in favor of regional. This idea of having global banking scares the hell out of me. It really does. You know, I go back and I think about George Washington. And, you know, since the right loves to bring up the founding fathers, got to have a founding father here. I think about George Washington's farewell address. And he said, you know, why forego the advantages of so peculiar a situation? Why quit our own to stand upon foreign ground? Why, by interweaving our destiny with that of any part of Europe, entangle our peace and prosperity in the toils of European ambition, rivalship, interest, humor, or caprice? You know, stay the hell out of everybody else's business. Don't intertwine, don't interweave our destiny. Stay clear of foreign entanglements. And you stop and you look at what we've gotten ourselves into, it's a scary mess. And when I come back, I want to talk a little bit more about it because, you know, the euro is taking a dive and evidently we're in trouble because we've got a bunch of our money with our too-big-to-fail banks because now we have a global banking system. Your thoughts when we come back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Here's a surprise that the power elites really hate. Many members of the 1% are joining the We Are the 99% protest movement. I don't mean that hedge fund billionaires are suddenly in the streets to show solidarity with millions of Americans who are fed up with the systemic inequality and corruption infesting our economic and political systems. No, no, those swells aren't about to dirty their Gucci's with any street action. Rather, I'm talking about another extra special 1% of our society, the soldiers who've been the boots on the ground in Washington's misguided and bloody wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Rather than marching in Veterans Day parades this year, thousands of vets from America's abused war class have been rallying with the Occupy movement. They're expressing their anger at being used in two senseless wars that enriched corporate contractors while the troops who are lucky enough to make it home alive can't find decent jobs and are shorted on the health and education programs they desperately need. In New York, more than 100 of our nation's soldiers proceeded in uniform from the Vietnam Vets Plaza to Wall Street, where they stood in formation in front of the stock exchange. Corporate profits on the rise, they chanted. Soldiers have to bleed and die. The powers that be, far from offering the salutes that vets deserve, much less offering the help they've earned, deployed a line of New York police to block these peaceful protesters from the financial manipulators inside and another line of police on horseback wielding nightsticks to threaten them. This is Jim Hightower saying this was a disgraceful show of force against those who have fought our wars. The police should be looking inside the financial empires, not threatening protesters. But their action exposes just how perverted and corrupt the power elites have become, and why all of us should support this burgeoning democracy movement.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, and going with that theme of staying the hell out of everybody else's business, I go back to Thomas Jefferson's March 4th, 1801 inaugural address. Think about that moment in history. A bloodless change of power. The moment in the history of the world where ideology completely changed hands. Without a bloodbath. I mean, that's the miracle of this country. He said in his inaugural address, peace, commerce, and honest friendship with all nations, entangling alliances with none. I mean, we're gonna play nice. We'll trade. You know, we'll be friends. We'll do whatever, but we're not getting involved in your petty conflicts. We're not getting involved in everything else. And you look around the world at what we've done. We're everywhere. I forget how many, 130 bases, 130 countries around the world we're in. I'd say we're fairly entangled. And you look at what's going on in Europe. They're saying that when you look at the amount of exposure American banks have to what's going on in Europe, you're talking about $4 trillion. And that if Europe plunges, I think it was Bernanke last week who said that we're not going to avoid the ill effects. We're not going to walk away from this unscathed. It's not something we're insulated from. And if it blows up, we go with it. This is part of that global banking society. This is part of the whole intertwined relationship that we have around the world. And I go back to the idea that the founders had, which is to have strength, not just militarily, but to have strength of economy, have strength of independence, have liberty. You know, those aren't just words on a page. We should have the ability to not have to deal with the Chinese or to deal with the Indians or whoever. But right now we're finding ourselves in all of these, what seem to be permanent, all these permanent entanglements, all of these free trade agreements, all of these alliances that, you know what, things change over years. NAFTA, can anybody really take a position and say NAFTA was a good idea? I'm sure if you made billions off of it, yeah, you would think it's a good idea. But ask the millions of workers who lost what were good-paying jobs. I got an email during the break. It says, a good piece to read, why Germany needs the euro. It's over at CNN Money. He says, it's all about the trade surplus that boosts the big German economic engine. Non-stoppable juggernaut. Something your aristocrats just don't get. You've been saying it for years. It's the trade deficit that's killing us. While the German worker, working people living in a world of robust prosperity, we live in poverty. It's because they have done smart things. They have a VAT tax. So they're basically subsidizing their products going overseas. They're subsidizing exports. The Chinese massively subsidizing exports. Why in God's name would you allow them to import into your country when you're not willing to do the same? So the question then becomes, are we willing to subsidize all of the companies that export things? And then isn't that kind of like socialism? Aren't we bailing out the companies? And is that what we want? I mean, I'm in favor of having sane trade policy that makes sure that we have an opportunity to produce what we need while trading those things that we cannot produce. And I look at President Obama working diligently to create what they're calling the world's largest free trade zone. On Sunday, Canada and Mexico followed Japan into the talks. So we may see the Trans-Pacific Partnership, something that I worried about a couple of years ago and talked about a couple of years ago when Bush was pushing for this. You got Michelle Bachmann, who is looking at China saying, it's pretty good. Their economy's growing. They don't have food stamps. They don't have safety net programs. They don't have any. They don't need any of that. They save for their own retirement, not mentioning to you that they really don't have retirement, that they are mostly going to work until they die. And that is, understand, that is the vision for the American worker. You know, I think it was Thomas Friedman who wrote about it, you know, what, 20 years ago? We would have this great leveling off with the rest of the world. Our standard of living would come way down. And we're hearing it now. You're hearing it with the people talking about the super secret commission. You know, how do we bring those seniors down? How do we get rid of that Social Security and that Medicare? How do we get them paying more? Let's give them vouchers. Oh, there's a great idea. More damn vouchers. Here, Granny, I know you got a bum hip and a bum ticker. Here's a $5,000 voucher. Go out there and get yourself some health care. Never going to happen. We both know that. And the wealthy will, they'll figure out a way. But you and me, the people who struggle and work and bust our behind every day, we're the ones going to suffer. And that's what they want. They want that desperation class. And, you know, I got into it this weekend with the guy, and he was talking, well, you don't like business. And I'm going, no, that's not true. I like business. I'm a small businessman myself. I believe in competition. I believe in fair play. I believe in having rules of the game. The difference is, I don't believe in monopolies. I don't believe in massive power taking control of our nation. I don't believe in a communist country having access to our markets, subsidizing their corporations in a mercantilist fashion. And this is where I think we can all agree. You want to make sure that your economy is beneficial to everybody. Well, the mistake we made in this country is we followed the Reagan philosophy. We followed the Reagan vision that this would no longer be an industrial-based country. We would be a service-based economy with a bunch of paper pushers and a bunch of management people, because we're all going to be professionals, doctors and lawyers and accountants and all of these desk jobs. We're all going to do that. We don't need any of that dirty manufacturing. We don't need to add value to anything. No, no. We can have the Chinese do it for us. And look at what's happening. They're kicking our behind. The standard of living for the American working class is shrinking at a rapid pace. And look, people aren't stupid. They see the Republicans. Nearly 70% believe they're the party of the rich, which blows my mind that they can win any election, how they can even be elected dog catcher. Just blows my mind. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Helen on line, too. How are you doing tonight, Helen?
Hi, dear. The thing about the Chinese, they do have a form of, not Social Security, but there's an allotment for the old people who helped with the revolution. And I read this in a book by a journalist, a Chinese journalist, the woman, the book was Z or something, and she's married to a Brit. So she has dual citizenship, and she still goes back and forth to home. But there's, you know, the allotment is very low, and the old people complain that they don't have enough, and they have to live in these little tiny subsidized houses, or maybe their children have to help them. And the younger people don't have that, but they do have it for the old communists. The farmers... they still have families that help them, and there is some measure of help over there for the poor, and this business that they haven't completely gone capitalist.
No, but from what I understand, the working people, they don't have a form of Social Security. There's no safety net to really speak of. From the way I understood it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but they're much like we were in the 1880s, 1890s.
No, it's not that bad. They like to paint it. I mean, some of these people, but I fault both the left and the right for trying to make it look so bad. But reading actual Chinese writers, it's not that bad. I mean, there is a problem, but it's a problem like we have. It's not spread out enough. There's not enough. It's not for the farmers. It's for the workers. So if you were a farmer all the time and you hadn't come into the city and worked for the communist government, you don't have that pension. And the pension is very small, but it's there.
All right, good. So then do you agree with Michelle Bachmann that we should...
Not as bad as they'd like to make it out to be.
So do you...
Socialism, it works, but they're getting to be capitalists, and that's the problem.
On paper, everything works. It's a matter of what happens.
Yeah, but no, they do have these pensions, but they become... they've gone to the capitalist. I mean, they think it's great, and they're becoming robber barons. And trying to get rid of all of the pensions. They're taking their cue from our own Republicans.
Well, a lot of them were educated here. I mean, to be honest, they were.
Yeah,
a lot of them.
I'm saying that, when you read actual people who are from that country, when you read their books, you get a little bit more truth.
Interesting. I'll have to take a look at some of that, because it was my impression that they didn't have a social safety net to speak of. That it was kind of a regional thing.
That's why I read Chinese authors and don't depend on just our own political writers.
Yeah, there was a couple of conversations I had with folks who had been back and forth. But I'll have to check into that. I appreciate it, Helen. Thank you.
Sure.
You know, I go back and I think about that, and the reality is as she said, they're not very very good pensions. They get a little something, but again, do we want to go back to that? I mean, and I'm really going to have to double check into that, because some of the conversations I've had with people paint it like the 1880s, 1890s here. Basically, you're on your own, which is where I think the conservative ideology wants to take us. And if you look at the decision today, evidently the Supreme Court will be hearing the case on Obamacare or the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. I guess here the oral arguments will be sometime in March, And I guess that I think they're going to hold it for like 5 hours, which is a huge amount of time. And it's interesting that, you know, the most recent decision on this came out of the U.S. Appeals Court for the District of Columbia, which upheld the mandate, said, you know what, despite questions raised as to our subject matter jurisdiction, the court concludes we have jurisdiction. And we affirm the district court's conclusion that the act is constitutional, written by Senior Circuit Judge Lawrence Hirsch Silberman. And you look at the latest poll that just came out from CNN. The individual mandate, a little more popular. In fact, you now have a majority of people, 52-47, 52% in favor of it, 47% opposed. Now, just in June, it was the other way. It was 54 opposed it, 44 were in support of it. So the more people are thinking about this, the more I think you're getting folks to come on board saying, look, we want to make sure people have access to something, but also you got to be in the game. Everybody has to be in this, one way or another. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. When we come back, we'll talk about this Chinese deal. Back after this.
Just make us be brave. Make us play nice. Let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class. Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers, in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job, they're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse. Because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Well, you know, when it comes to trade, that's one of the theme songs. I think it's both parties. It's not just not the Republicans. Not at all. I mean, in fact, you know, NAFTA was signed into law by Bill Clinton. Granted, it was conceived under Reagan. It was fully negotiated under George H.W. Bush, but the name on the dotted line, Bill Clinton. And you look at Colombia, South Korea, and Panama, may have been dreamt up during the Reagan year, during the Bush years, still signed by President Obama. And he's out again pushing more of this free trade, more of this open borders, more of this. you almost can't believe it on a certain level. But this Trans-Pacific Partnership, I understand. You got to get into that market, but at what cost? Because they're smart enough. Look, the Chinese are smart enough not to open their doors and say, sure, come and devastate our economy with your imports. They're not going to allow us to do what they've done to us. It's just not going to happen. They're not going to let us dump in their ground. That's going to happen. They're too smart for that. And, you know, Obama's trying to grow a cent, maybe a little bit. You know, he said, you know, this whole exchange things, and look, you know, enough's enough already. He says, I understand, you know, changes are difficult. He said, I get it. But the United States and other countries, and he says, I think understandably feel that enough's enough. The currency rate has to inflate. They've got to stop pegging the yuan against the dollar. They've got to stop artificially lowering their currency rate. And you go, well, what's so big about that? Well, if they're pushing down the value of their dollar, that means that their exports are cheaper. So they can sell their stuff in our market cheaper than we can even buy the raw materials, probably. And that makes our stuff more expensive, so it's not competitive in their market. Do you get this? I mean, and this is something that nobody really wants to talk about. You would think that this would be a no-brainer. Republicans used to be for a currency act. They used to be for making sure that the Chinese were playing by fair rules. Now, not so much. They were grandstanding a couple of years ago. In fact, passed the currency bill. Now that there's one passed the Senate and in the House, well, the Republicans don't want any part of it. And at some point, there's part of me that says, you know what we have to do? Eventually, what has to happen is the dollar has to stop being the reserve currency. At some point, we have to give up that responsibility, because if you stop and think about the trade that's gone on between the U.S. and China last year, was $457 billion. We had a deficit of $273 billion. I'm sorry, I think we're having a serious problem. So now that $273 billion trade deficit, and stick with me on this, we had all this activity between the two countries. We're buying we're buying all of their stuff, they're buying a few things of ours, a few trinkets, a little Indian bracelet, something like that. We have this $273 billion deficit. They're holding, in theory, $273 billion of our dollars. As the reserve currency of the globe, those dollars have to come back. They got to come back to us. It's got to come back to the U.S. because we're the holder of the reserve currency. Everything, all transactions are done in dollars. So what are they buying from us? Well, nothing, because we have a trade deficit of $273 billion. So what they're buying of us are our companies. They're buying our property. They're buying our debt. They're buying us. So at Christmas time, when we go to the store and go, oh, I love this made in China thing, you have just contributed to the deficit. You have just contributed to our downfall. So part of me says, you know, having learned just a little bit about John Maynard Keynes, his theory was you don't have one nation holding the reserve currency. You have an exchange. And everything is exchanged into an international currency. He came up with the name Bancor. I don't know what it's, I don't know where he came up with it, but he came up with Bancor. All currencies float against the Bancor. Countries that have trade deficits are encouraged to lower those deficits. And they do it through the manipulation of the currency. And if you continually have surpluses, then there was a mechanism in there to punish the country with the surplus. Not to reduce consumption, not to reduce demand, but to level the playing field so everybody comes up together. And the answer to all of this, and I know my environmental friends are going to lose their mind, but the idea in all of this is that you have more consumption of goods and services. And that more activity leads to more employment leads to more wealth. More demand, that's the answer. Having more people with money in their pocket, that's the answer. Not having one country being the ultimate winner in this, which is right now the Chinese and the Germans. The countries that are practicing some form of protectionism are the ones who are doing well. Because they're protecting their nation. They're protecting their workers. We seem to be the only ones dumb enough not to be doing it. And I look at this, you know, $273 billion just one year. And it's going to be higher than that this year. And you can almost bet if nothing is done and we continue on the same path, nothing's going to be, it's going to be higher the year after. So the more I think about this stuff, maybe the BRIC countries have it right. They're going to start using their own currency. Until eventually there's an international accord, maybe this crisis will bring about that. I don't know, but at some point we've got to stop being so intertwined. Because when you have one bad apple, when you have one bad player, it brings everybody down. Just a thought. And a frustrating one. You know, and you think about all this free trade talk. All of this stuff here in this country is going to lead to more unemployment. Understand that. For as much as, you know, the grand jobs plan with South Korea was going to increase jobs, I'm not seeing how when you're losing more manufacturing. I'm not seeing how Panama is going to help increase jobs here when all it's going to be is an offshore financial tax haven. And Colombia, really? I mean, how are you going to justify that? Oh, but they buy our high-tech stuff. Yeah. Okay. And you look at the fact that it's going to cause more unemployment. And what you see is you see the Republicans. And what was the big fight? You remember the big fight over the three trade agreements? Because they would have sailed through months ago. The big fight was over the trade adjustment assistance. The big fight was over what do we do with those people who are thrown out of their jobs when those jobs move overseas? And what I love is the right wing. They come up with, well, it's the unions who are killing all the jobs. It's the unions who forced all the jobs out of the country because they demand too high of wages. How low should we go? How low? What level is sufficient? Dollar an hour? 50 cents? Loaf of bread? What? Got an email during the break. Noticed the other day that the Germany's parliament was looking into setting its minimum wage at the euro, €8.50. That'd be about almost 12 bucks an hour in U.S. dollars. Substantially better than our $7.25. Another government, unlike ours, actually representing the working class citizens. And, you know, I look at that, and you stop and you think about how the German working class fits into governing themselves and fits into the structure there. They actually have worker representatives on the board of directors. Do you know any company here in the U.S. that actually has a representative of the workers sitting on their board of directors? Because I don't. I'm Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If you know one company, I'd love to hear it because I can't think of any. But in Germany, from what I understand, every company that has a board of directors has someone, a representative, and in some cases, multiple representatives sitting on their board. So there's no shenanigans going on. And if there is, somebody knows about it. There's sunshine. There's daylight. There's transparency. I mean, you stop and you think about all the stuff that's going on in this country with these big corporations. At some point, you go, how come nobody said anything? Well, because they're all in it together. Drives me insane. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make history happen!
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Got by the way.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You know, like our listener Stosh, some 650,000 people move their money from, the big banks into credit unions or smaller local banks. 650,000 new customers for credit unions and small and local banks. I think that's just an amazing accomplishment. Because you know what? They figured out how to screw the working people. And I look at this latest story that grabbed my attention. It was reported over by Huffington Post. They're talking about this Shawana Busby, who is on unemployment in South Carolina. And, you know, she gets a check of $264 a week from the state of South Carolina because of the unemployed insurance benefits. And the state has contracted with Bank of America, like a lot of states do. And I know Pennsylvania contracts with people as well. I'm not sure who it is, but you know, they give out these electronic bank transfer cards. It's no longer, you know, the food stamps, and it's no longer checks. Everything is done through electronic bank transfer. And what they've done is they've contracted with Bank of America, and I've been hearing about this for a while, where if you go to use the card, they charge you for every transaction over two or three or whatever it is. Or if you use one out of the network, they charge you for a boatload of money there. And according to her, every time she goes, it's as high as $5 per transaction. She says in the time that she's been unemployed, she's lost about $350. And that money goes right to Bank of America. And, you know, you think about, and I remember this right when the ATM cards came out. They were trying to charge you every time you went into the bank, to encourage you to do the ATM thing. Same thing here. If Bank of America customers, they can be charged a buck and a half to speak to a customer service representative for more than once a month. So you get that first one free, but if you need a second time, it's going to cost you. If you use an out-of-network ATM, who knows what it could cost you. You happen to enter the wrong PIN, they charge you 50 cents for that. I know some, if you check the balance, they charge you for that as well. So what they've figured out how to do is, while you got people down, let's give them a good shot. Let's kick them again. This, my friends, this is capitalism at work. Unregulated, laissez-faire. You need the money. We got the service. You're screwed, capitalism. Now, this is something that we used to, as a society, say, well, you're down on your luck. We're going to make sure we protect you a little bit. Not anymore. These big banks, they're making a tidy little sum as the bagman in the middle. And this is something that we used to provide publicly. We did for ourselves. You look at U.S. Bank Corp. Made $357 million in revenue from its unemployment benefit division. A quarter of its total revenue. J.P. Morgan made almost $5.5 billion in net revenue for most of the last year in the division that handles food stamp cards. And I look at this and I go, really? We let this happen? We let these banksters get away again? I think of the Bush clip. Screw me once, shame on me. Shame on you. Screw me twice, can't get screwed again. No, we're getting screwed constantly. And you hear people talking about, we don't want to raise taxes on the wealthy because someday I may be wealthy. And our stat of the day from the folks over at the Too Much Online blog. They say, just how many Americans from the bottom 99% have made it into that upper strata, into that top 1% over the years? They point to Tax Foundation numbers between 1999 and 2007. And they claim only 0.1% of Americans in the bottom 60% moved into the top 1%. Of the 20% of Americans right above that bottom 60%, only 0.3% reached the upper strata, that rarefied air at the top of the mountain. You're talking 1, 2, 3, 4 people tops? A very small amount. But to have this mentality that, someday I'm gonna be mega rich, that's why I don't want to raise taxes, has really screwed this country up. And look, I'd love to be, I'm still hoping I'm going to find that winning lottery ticket. Not going to happen. But how many times have we heard the story about the welfare queen? How many times have we heard the story about the poor small family farmer who lost his farm because of the evil estate tax? Yet we never could find either one of these people. Now, I'm sure they're off married somewhere, driving their Bentley around, sipping margaritas, maybe on their yacht, maybe. But you know what I do know? I do know you look at the report from the Citizens for Tax Justice. You look at all of these companies who pay nothing. And you look at the industries. You look at the industries who have gotten huge. Over half of all tax subsidies have gone to 4 industries. Can you guess which ones? Anyone? Wall Street. Number one. The utilities, gas and electric, number 2. Telecommunications, number 3. Oil, gas and pipelines, number 4. Nothing on there about, alternative energy, nothing on there about how we rebuild our infrastructure, none of that stuff. Yet all we hear from the right wing is, we gave money to Solyndra! Not the tens of billions of dollars that we gave away in subsidies to the financial industry. Nope, none of that. It blows my mind over the last 3 years. Pepco Holdings paid a negative 57.6% tax rate, which means that we paid them 57% of their profits to be in business here. We paid them. Who's talking about welfare? Where's this idea of welfare? We paid them 57% of their profits just to be in business. I mean, it's mind-blowing if you think about it. And yet the people on the right are saying, well, you know, we want corporations unrestrained. Well, you know what? I think those corporations would beg to differ. We like being in the government pocket. I think GE is very happy not paying taxes and actually getting money back at the end of the year. I think they're thrilled about that. So you see all of these people who are saying, you know what, we've had enough. We've had enough. You see people around the country out in the streets saying we've had enough. And all I keep hearing on the mainstream media, turn on the news, oh, a violent fringe. You know, there's one or two idiots who broke a window. And now you've got all across the country, you got these mayors in these cities cracking down on these people who are simply going to the streets for their constitutional right of free speech. And what I find absolutely ridiculous is this, oh, the health conditions. Well, why not help them? Why not put a porta potty in? Why not make sure that things are clean and sanitary? Instead of saying, we're going to go in and we're going to spend millions of dollars cracking heads and we're going to spend millions of dollars tear gassing people. I mean, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, you had 25 heavily armed commandos going in to break up, what, 50 people? There's reports of, in one instance, people with automatic weapons. And the cops came in with automatic weapons. And I think about this kid who was just released, the Marine who was injured in Occupy Oakland. And, you know, you stop and you think about, why do you see these veterans out there? And I think the veterans are where they should be, out supporting these people. Because, you know, you just had Veterans Day on Friday. And you look at all of the homelessness. You look at all of the poverty, all of the unemployment. And what are they doing in D.C.? Nothing. Nothing. There are no jobs bills. There's no investment. There's status quo. There's stall. There's delay. That's what they do. And I mean, the numbers on homelessness, the numbers on poverty, the numbers on unemployment of vets. Again, I go back to what I said when we first invaded, when we first got into this. My main hope was that we didn't treat this group of heroes, this group of veterans, the way we treated the Vietnam vets. When they came back, we dumped them into the streets. And some of the reports I'm seeing, we're doing a little better. I wouldn't say all that much better. It's sad. Unemployment rates for veterans aged 18 to 24 was about 20%. 20%. On any given night, you've got thousands of vets homeless. Is that right? Is that how we treat people? What are we going to do? What are we going to do if we have another catastrophe and we have to ask the next group of heroes to step forward? What are you going to do? They say on any given night there's 75,000 vets homeless. What are you going to do? Are we helping their addiction? Are we helping them with PTSD? Are we doing anything to stop the suicide rates? I sure hope so. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Doug Cunningham from Workers Independent News, also the host of the new program, The People's Mic, heard out in Wisconsin. Right back after this. The list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone. Oh, it's a war on the workers. War on the workers.
Proud defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
A new commercial launched on Veterans Day calls on the House of Representatives to vote no on a resolution that could see as many as 120,000 postal workers laid off. The Postal Workers and Mail Handlers Union launched the ad to bring attention to the fact that the U.S. Postal Service employs more veterans than any other civilian employer. According to the organization, as many as 26,000 veterans could be put out of work if the legislation passes in the House. In addition to the layoffs, that plan also calls for an end to Saturday deliveries and the shuttering of thousands of post offices around the country. A second plan introduced in the Senate doesn't end Saturday deliveries and seeks to buffer the layoffs with buyouts. Under the Senate plan, the Office of Personnel Management would be authorized to repay the Postal Service for $7 billion in overpayments made to the employee retirement system. $2 billion of that would be used to encourage employees to take early retirement, and if 100,000 employees do so, the Postmaster General believes it could save the service as much as $8 billion per year. A union-affiliated finance and investment company is joining the American Federation of Teachers to invest in Oregon public schools. Doug Cunningham has more on the story.
Ulico, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company, says it will collaborate with government, unions, and businesses to invest up to $15 million in Oregon schools that include low-cost energy retrofits. Ulico CEO Edward M. Smith says Ulico is committed to providing specialty insurance and investment products to meet the needs of working men and women, as it has since its founding in 1927. AFL-CIO Building and Construction Trades President Mark Ayers says these kinds of investments are invaluable to members of the building trades who are grateful for the chance to strengthen communities where they live and work. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten, meanwhile, says that she's gratified by this investment because it will help ensure children have access to facilities which help them reach their full potential. This $15 million Oregon Public Schools investment is part of a broad commitment to action by a number of unions and investors through a Clinton Global Initiative earlier this year. Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing tall against the multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
Madison, Cairo, fascism track, next stop Ohio. Trying to kill labor, that's their jihad, huh? What's gonna happen when the people all rise up? Sad thing is, so we all labor. What you expect to hear? Millionaires on the papers.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Ever check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So tomorrow, the big day, the recall effort begins. Like I said earlier, I'm told up to $70 million this election could cost, which is just a mind-blowing amount of money. But you know what? You know, when the power structure says they want somebody, it'll be interesting to see how this goes. Anyway, there's a great new program starting out in Wisconsin. Out of the whole this whole uprising, the folks over at Workers Independent News have come out with the program, the People's Mic. It started today with the host, Doug Cunningham. I've got Doug on the line. Doug, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having us. We appreciate it.
Congratulations on the start of a new program, another one sorely and much needed.
Well, I thank you again for that, and we had our debut program tonight. And, of course, that recall effort in Wisconsin is actually going to begin in just a couple of hours, because the 1 minute after midnight, there are dozens of events all over the state where signatures are actually going to start being collected right away, because Wisconsin can't wait. It's a big day. We've all waited for this for months and months, ever since hundreds of thousands of people over a two-month period turned out at the state capitol.
Yeah, I was looking at an article over at Politiscope, Tea Party plans premeditated felony, and I was looking at some of the statements on Facebook that, you know, this reporter had found, people talking about, I'm going to go collect signatures and shred them. I'm going to go collect them and burn them. I'm going to go collect them and put them in the bottom of bird cages. I mean, pretty much saying we're going to commit a felony.
Yeah, that's a serious felony to even do that. We had the co-chairs of United Wisconsin on the People's Mic with Doug Cunningham tonight, and they said that they're going to be watching that very carefully for any cases of fraud, and we're going to hope that the people of Wisconsin keep their eyes and ears open in case that really does happen. I don't know how much of that was just right-wingers venting and how much of it is actually going to be attempted, but one of the things that everybody in Wisconsin has to know about these recall petitions is you can actually sign as many recall petitions as you want to sign, and then when they are added up, the Government Accountability Board here will actually get rid of the duplicate signatures anyway. So if you have some doubt about the person showing up at your door, you can always report them and see what comes of it. But I hope that that doesn't happen. But you know what? Even if it does, this recall effort is so powerful, it is so deep and so intense that it will overcome whatever dirty tricks that the Republicans or Walker supporters can throw at it.
Yeah, but the thing is we see all around the country. Here in Pennsylvania, they're trying to push through one of these voter suppression bills, because, we had four cases of, people who may have voted when they weren't supposed to, and, oh my God, the world's coming to an end. Found four cases nationwide. So now they're pushing this scheme to make sure that, my grandmother, who hasn't had a driver's license in 20 years, can't vote. People across the country, and especially the poor, the elderly, and the, students, trying to suppress that vote to keep them out. So you're doing that all simultaneously, seeing some of these shenanigans going on. Makes me think, and maybe I'm missing something, makes me think that our friends on the right don't want us voting.
I think they don't want us voting because I happen to believe that there is actually a progressive majority in America. You go to different key issues in this country about whether we want to tax the rich more, whether we want to save the social safety net, and whether we want to protect workers' rights, issues like that. And the majority of Americans are on the progressive side when asked those questions individually. And, time after time, people told their governors and their state legislators that, no, they don't want collective bargaining attacked. And what did we see in Ohio on November 8th? The people actually came out in a very convincing way in a landslide vote, and they crushed the attack on collective bargaining there because the majority of people in Ohio certainly aren't members of unions. I wish, but unions aren't that strong. So, the 61 or 62% of those folks who voted to protect collective bargaining in Ohio did so because they are on that side of the issue. And, typically, time after time, we hear, progressives are a minority. Actually, I think we are, both here in Wisconsin and across the country, actually a majority. And we're about to see that play out. And it's a very interesting dynamic because, what happens if the majority of the country wants to take our nation in one direction, policy-wise, and our politicians keep trying to take us in the other direction, the direction of the 1% who control everything? Well, that's corporate rule. And this country has had a history of rebelling once or twice against tyrannical rule. And you can't get much more tyrannical, actually, than corporate rule of a society.
Yeah, and that's why it's important that programs like the People's Mic and others across the country begin to sprout up. Because as you know, and I'm sure my listeners know, when you have this mass consolidation, I've been saying for a while, 80% of everything we see, hear, and read owned by five multinational corporations, not even really American corporations, but multinational corporations, that not good for democracy.
It's not good, and they own the media infrastructure. The only saving grace for us in this technological age has been that the people have access to technology that allows us to get our message out as well and to get our news out. We still are not matching the corporate media in terms of sheer numbers of people that they can reach on a daily basis and have a permanent institution like that that can reach those folks. But if anybody wants to get information about what's really happening in America, whether it be the Occupy protest, the Wisconsin recall, the Ohio vote, or whatever, those resources are now there via the Internet, social media, and other things. And it's amazing, that kind of power, because people are beginning to awaken. The issue for me, I think, from my perspective, when I look at things like this in Wisconsin, Ohio, and elsewhere, I don't have any doubt in my mind that the majority of Americans support those kind of progressive goals. The thing is, though, we've got to somehow organize ourselves into a power that's strong enough to wrest control of our country from the corporations who dominate and control it. And if we truly are the majority, and if America truly is a representative democracy, then the people will find a way and an outlet to do that. And that's what we're struggling to do here in Wisconsin. That's what they did convincingly on collective bargaining in Ohio. And we drew great inspiration from that. And we hope that our effort is energetic and successful.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Doug Cunningham, host of The People's Mic, also a member of the team over at Workers Independent News. They produce those wonderful news clips at the top of the hour, and we're grateful for those. But let's talk about The People's Mic again for a second. How can people hear it? I know you're in Wisconsin locally, but let's say someone in our listening area wanted to tune in to Doug Cunningham, host of The People's Mic. How would they go about that?
One thing you could just do is simply Google The People's Mic. It'll probably come up. But the actual radio station here in Madison that we're on is 92.1 FM. It's WXXM. Its actual promotional nickname for their station is The Mic. It is a progressive talk station right here in Madison. It abandoned local programming for a while, had some national progressive talkers on. And now we have two shows on, my show, The People's Mic with Doug Cunningham, and another show called Out Loud with Mary Carroll that's also locally produced in Madison is also progressive. One of the big differences in our program, I mean, we are going to be progressive through and through, obviously, but the inspiration for the name of this program, The People's Mic, actually came from when I saw The People's Mic being used in the Capitol protests in Madison, the original Occupy protests this year. And what they would do is they would be crowded in, and I'm talking thousands of people inside the Capitol Rotunda actually occupying it, and they would have that many people inside, and they would have one microphone, one little speaker, or a bullhorn. They called that the People's Mic, and anybody who wanted to from the audience, from the protesting crowd, could come up and speak their piece and express themselves and magnify their voice. That's what I'm trying to do. That's what all of us at Workers Independent News are trying to do with this program, The People's Mic with Doug Cunningham. We're trying to amplify and magnify the voice of the powerless many, so that we can speak some truth to the powerful few.
And what we need are more programs like that, more voices to enrich the the discussion, because for too long, all we've been hearing, and I get this, I'm sure you will, and I'm sure you have, from people saying, well, you know, I hear what you're talking about, and, you know, I don't hear anybody else saying that. This is just some way out, conspiracy you're part of, some plot that you're against, that you're not talking the same way that the Limbaughs and the Becks and the Hannitys and the whole stable of megaphones for the mega rich, the sputum that comes out of their mouth. You're talking about something different that we haven't heard before.
That's right, and I hope that we are able to offer some creative content that's interesting to people not only in Madison but around the nation. I mean, I happen to think that these days there really is no such thing as local anymore. I mean, we are all so interconnected that we and these attacks on collective bargaining, the billionaire and multimillionaire agenda that's being pushed by these corporations and their bought and paid for politicians, that's a national level event. That is a coordinated assault, a coordinated agenda on a nationwide and even international basis. And so, you know, while we are going to have local content on the People's Mic, I want also to draw those connections and connect us to our brothers and sisters in the Occupy movement, our brothers and sisters in the labor movement everywhere in the country. All of these issues that are so vital to all of us and to our families, we have got to unite and come together as a powerful force. If we start to get an inkling, by we, I mean the people of this nation who want a progressive agenda. If you start to get an inkling that you actually have some power and that maybe you've been lied to, that we're a small minority with no power, then that in and of itself is empowering, and we can rise up then and do something that's good for this country and good for all working families.
So that's what I've been saying. As soon as people feel that they have some power, they feel that they have a voice, they like that, and they want to increase that. And a lot of the folks that I've met at the Occupies that we've been at have said, you know, for the first time, I feel like I matter. I feel like my opinion, my voice, my thoughts matter. As were before, you were just, you know, kind of walking on the treadmill. And I think the wealth class, the investor class, the Wall Street people, they've got to be looking at this and kind of worrying, which is why I think we're seeing the escalation in violence around the country as you're trying to see the police forces break this stuff up.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, that is absolutely shameful and reprehensible. I'm in contact with the Occupy movement from around the country, the various media teams from Occupy Oakland and other places, and what they did there is just absolutely shocking and horrendous, and an assault on the people and an assault on our Constitution and our Bill of Rights. You know, free speech and free assembly is not a riot. There's no reason to show up in riot gear when people are peacefully assembled and expressing their grievances against the government, petitioning the government for redress of grievances, and then gathering. The Constitution doesn't say anything about, you know, you have a right to peaceable assembly, but not here, or you have a right to peaceable assembly, but not 24/7, or you have a right to peaceable assembly, but not if it's irritating or inconvenient to others. You know, this simply says you have that right, and the police around the country ought to start respecting the right. Elected officials around the country ought to start respecting those rights. And, you know, if they don't respect those rights, we're headed down a darker path, perhaps, and nobody wants to see it go there. So, you know, the most important uplifting thing that working people everywhere in the reach of our voices right now can know is that we have tremendous power. And you have to be an engaged citizen. And we hope to engage more and more of those folks on the People's Mic and with Workers Independent News and our outreach there. And, you know, hopefully this effort will succeed. I mean, here tonight in Wisconsin, I mean, they're kicking off so many events, dozens. The State Democratic Party chair, Mike Tate, said that by tomorrow he expects that there will be signatures, thousands of signatures, from every single county in Wisconsin. So this Recall Walker effort is extremely important. We've waited a long, long time to get here, and we're going to drive this on home, and we'll have a recall election in the spring. And that'll be only the third time in American history that governors have been recalled. Uh-oh. And so two of those governors were actually recalled from office.
And that's why I'm excited to see what happens tomorrow. How many signatures do they need? And I think it's the next 60 days.
Yeah, it's within 60 days and 540,208. So it's 540,208 needed. United Wisconsin, which is the organization that's spearheading most of the effort, they already have a database of over 200,000 folks who have signed up and said, yes, I will sign a recall petition. So they've already got kind of a jump start on that. There's another organization called We Are Wisconsin, which is more closely affiliated with unions and labor. And that organization is also going to be circulating petitions. So, you know, they're going to obviously try for a cushion of a couple of 100,000 in case some are stricken for, you know, whatever reason, one reason or the other. But those signatures within 60 days, and that will force a recall election against Walker, and the petitions all have to be turned in by January 17th.
You know, we had talked with Malin Mitchell not too long ago, and he had said that it was his thought that this election, since it has no caps, the wealth class can spend as much money as it wants. He thought that, you know, you could see an election for a gubernatorial recall election up to $70 million.
Absolutely. And Governor Walker already is up on television with ads. He started with Monday Night Football, the Packers, and he spent $300,000 for this next week in Wisconsin media markets on television. So he is already out of the box, spending lots of money to be up on television. So we're going to have to overcome with people power what they have in their dollar power. And it's one of those classic struggles, you know, when you have a progressive working families movement who is aligned against the corporatist agenda, they have an unlimited amount of money. And believe me, they're going to pour it into Wisconsin to try to save Walker. But Walker, I think, is unsalvageable. I think that he will go down, and it's going to be a hard-fought battle. But I believe the people in Wisconsin are determined. And on the 19th, on the weekend here, we're going to have an actual kickoff rally in Madison. And there are going to be lots of buses coming in from around the state and even from outside the state. And we're going to be kicking this off officially with a huge turnout, hopefully, for that rally at the Capitol. And signatures, of course, will be collected at that event.
Excellent. And I look forward to hearing more about that. Again, congratulations on the program, The People's Mic. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Doug Cunningham's name. It'll take you over there. Congratulations. You've got a friend here at The Rick Smith Show. We wish you nothing but the best, brother.
Hey, Rick, thanks a lot, brother. We appreciate your help and support, and we hope we wish you all success, too, with what you're doing. And together, hopefully, at some point, we will be able to achieve the change we want and actually have a country run by, of, and for the working people in the country. How about that?
Amen. Amen. Doug Cunningham, The People's Mic, thanks so much. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
On the Capitol to lobby leaders for involvement. 3,000 people screaming out,
where's our government?
Lawsuits and arraignments, members under company surveillance. Public divided, either they love us or they hate us. Off billions off our back, and it's still not enough. They should have looked into a gap
that we never give up.
We'll be here one day longer. The people's voice is stronger.
The people's voice is stronger.
We're not a hard-core money. We will talk with respect. Keep fighting.
class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Here's a surprise that the power elites really hate. Many members of the 1% are joining the We Are the 99% protest movement. I don't mean that hedge fund billionaires are suddenly in the streets to show solidarity with millions of Americans who are fed up with the systemic inequality and corruption infesting our economic and political systems. No, no, those swells aren't about to dirty their Gucci's with any street action. Rather, I'm talking about another extra special 1% of our society, the soldiers who've been the boots on the ground in Washington's misguided and bloody wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Rather than marching in Veterans Day parades this year, thousands of vets from America's abused war class have been rallying with the Occupy movement. They're expressing their anger at being used in two senseless wars that enriched corporate contractors while the troops who are lucky enough to make it home alive can't find decent jobs and are shorted on the health and education programs they desperately need. In New York, more than 100 of our nation's soldiers proceeded in uniform from the Vietnam Vets Plaza to Wall Street, where they stood in formation in front of the stock exchange. Corporate profits on the rise, they chanted. Soldiers have to bleed and die. The powers that be, far from offering the salutes that vets deserve, much less offering the help they've earned, deployed a line of New York police to block these peaceful protesters from the financial manipulators inside and another line of police on horseback wielding nightsticks to threaten them. This is Jim Hightower saying this was a disgraceful show of force against those who have fought our wars. The police should be looking inside the financial empires, not threatening protesters. But their action exposes just how perverted and corrupt the power elites have become, and why all of us should support this burgeoning democracy movement.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So, you know, George Will, somebody I don't agree with often, he had a statement that I kind of agreed with while he was on Christine Amanpour's program. He said a rule is when there are four women, there may be 24 women, talking about Herman Cain. He said there's a pattern here, says, you know, the four of them not telling the truth? Really? Well, we'll see. And again, you know, it is what it is. Herman makes me laugh. And I hope he's in it for the long haul because I'm changing my registration just to vote for him. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Richard on line one. How are you doing tonight, Richard?
I'm doing just great.
So what's on your mind?
The beginning of the show, you started off about Joe Paterno and Penn State.
Yep.
And my feelings on that is he's getting a royal screwing on this deal. He's not the one that saw the act occur. He did report it to his superiors when it come to his attention. And if I understand correctly, the young fellow that saw it later became a assistant coach at Penn State, who is now on paid leave.
Yep.
So I guess he doesn't talk to the reporters.
Yep. Well, no, he's on paid leave for a whole plethora of reasons, and one of them probably, since he's hired an employment attorney, is the whistleblower protection, since he did say something. Now, look, here's my position, and I understand where you're coming from. The reality here is I hold Joe Paterno to a higher standard than I hold a graduate assistant. Joe Paterno was like God. He is somebody who you expect a bit more moral fiber, a bit more responsibility, a bit more out of. The fact that he did the legal minimum to me is unforgivable. The fact that he did the legal minimum to me tells me that the people above him put him in his place. But here again, this guy was a god. Nothing went on at Penn State without him saying, what was what? So for you to say, well, you know, he's getting this, I don't agree with that at all. He's a cancer. Every one of them should have been fired, the entire staff, every one of them.
I agree with what you're saying, but at the same time, the district attorney of Sumner County said there would be no felony charges brought forth when they shut the investigation down when this first came to light, you know, back when it happened.
Here again.
So they've been covering this up, you know what I mean, for
I
what,
agree.
10 years or more?
I absolutely agree with you. The reality being what it is.
Take the fall instead of the district attorney who said there'd be no criminal charges brought, I think is a little bit off the wall. So much for Joe.
But no, hold on, stop. Whoa, stop. This thing with McCreary was not what they were investigating. No. They were investigating the other claim. That he had lathered some boy up and there were some allegations and then they went, they actually listened in on the conversation with Sandusky and this kid's mother where he said, I wish I were dead and you're never going to forgive me. That's completely different.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the district attorney set aside. This thing that McCreary went to Paterno went up to the other two idiots. This is something completely different. This never went, in my opinion, didn't go anywhere. And in fact, according to the document, never went even to the campus police. This was covered up right inside. So for me personally, I hold Joe Paterno to a higher standard than I hold a graduate assistant or anyone else because he's Joe Paterno. If he can't be held to a higher standard, who can be?
I will agree with that.
Okay. But so
like I said, you know, I mean, if I understood correctly on the radio program that I heard, the campus police shut the investigation down on that.
Not on that incident, on something else.
No, I don't have the particulars of the papers that was filed, you know what I mean, or the access to the internet to get them.
Yeah, understand, there are eight victims here. There are 40 counts. This isn't just one incident. This is a couple of things. In fact, there was a janitor who saw something as well, and reported it. And, you know, there's a pattern here. And look, he's innocent until proven guilty. But at the end of the day, in my opinion, and this is where we can disagree, Joe Paterno got exactly what he deserved in this matter. And they all should be fired. Absolutely every last one of them. And I talked about this yesterday. You know, the high school I went to, there was a god of a local sports figure, the athletic director, who had been molesting kids for 30, 40 years. And when the floodgates opened, then everybody came out. But everybody knew up until the point that the floodgates opened, and no one did a thing. That's why I say there's a cancer at Penn State. All of them got to go. What else you got on your mind?
Okay, the Chinese yen, them protecting their money. I can understand them doing this, but at the same time, our businessmen are taking our businesses to China.
Yep.
So they're working with yen. That's what they pay their employees with. That's what they buy their raw materials with. And that's what they're collecting when they sell the item until they bring the money back to the United States to spend. So I could see where they would want to devalue it in
absolutely.
Order to make it more profitable.
Sure, absolutely. I don't blame the Chinese at all.
And then The main reason I called, I heard tonight on the news where
blame us.
Coming up in March, the Supreme Court is going to take up the health care, the Obamacare bill.
Yep.
To see if it is constitutional.
Yep.
And they're saying that I've heard different people say that it's unconstitutional for the government to mandate that you buy health insurance.
It mandates you have to buy car insurance.
That's what I was going to say. They mandate you buy car insurance. Plus, they mandate you even buy a tag for the back of your car.
Yep.
They mandate that you get it inspected.
And at the end of this, and look, there have been several courts who have ruled it constitutional, a couple that have said no. At the end of all of this, it comes down to are you responsible? You know, this individual mandate, I think, it has to be a part of it. And it's oddly enough, it's something Republicans used to be in favor of. In fact, this is Newt Gingrich's idea back in the early 90s, something that he was in favor of then. Now, all of a sudden, not so much.
I think it should come right in with your Social Security. When they deduct your Social Security off, okay, so they take another 3%, 4%, 5%, whatever. You know, I mean, I don't know what the magic number is. You'd have to run the numbers and see what it would take to do it. And then you're automatically covered off your Social Security number.
Right there with you.
And the doctors, you know what I mean? Okay, so you don't have a doctor where you're at. That's the same way with the military. If they need a radar technician in Anchorage, Alaska, they pull up the skiff of how many guys they've got that's qualified to do this job, and it's an eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Who wants to go? Oh, nobody? Oh, okay. Joe, you're going.
Well, I mean, they do what they do with Medicare. They incentivize it to the point where somebody wants to go. And they, you know, they pay a little bit of a premium in rural areas to make sure that they have the services they need. Basically, what I'm in favor of is a Medicare for all system. It's basically what we've done with Medicare. The system's in place. The structure's there. Everybody I know likes it. They're happy with it. Why not expand it so I can buy into it? Affix a cost to it. Tell me how much, and we'll go from there.
I totally agree.
Well, I mean, this is...
If the government... officials like Obama, you know what I mean? He sneezes and, you know, you got four doctors running up to him. Well, you're okay. You know, I mean, that's what I expect everybody to treat me like that, but I'd like to be able to go to the doctor without having to sell off my last born.
Yeah, and I'd like to be able to, if I get sick, I'd like to know that I'm not going to lose my home and go bankrupt and end up like the guy I talked about earlier who, you know, we spent a whole bunch of money making him better only to send him out into the streets and be homeless.
Right. And it makes no sense. And they've got all these buildings, you know what I mean, that they've condemned schools that, you know what I mean, well, it's too old, the whole class. Why can't they convert them into housing shelters?
Well, because then we couldn't manipulate the system and we couldn't have all of our federal funding for this and that and the other thing.
Like HUD.
Yeah, everyone's got their hand in the till, and the reality is it's the big money people who've got their hands there, and they know how to play game the system.
Well, that's why they want everything privatized. In fact, you know what I mean? Maybe this thing with Joe Paul could be the beginning of the privatization of Penn State instead of it being a state-funded university.
Well, they get 2% of their funding from the state?
I don't know what they get from the state, but, you know what I mean? It's considered the University of Pennsylvania, Penn State.
Well, it's Penn State University. There is a University of Pennsylvania. It's at one of the Ivy League schools, and that is private. But before I have to run off to break, I want to go back to the China thing. So okay. you're in favor of the Chinese undervaluing their currency. You're in favor of that.
No, I'm not in favor.
Oh,
of
okay.
It. I'm not in favor of it.
You understand it?
I'm not in favor of that, but at the same time, the people that are benefiting by it don't want it changed, which is the big business, which are Republican filibusters.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify that because you know some could.
I think that we should have a tariff on, you know, I mean, if their goods come up to the price of ours.
There you go. See, and that's reasonable.
Last but not least, Doug Cunningham with that People's Fight.
Yep.
He gave the station that he was on, but I didn't quite get it in time. He gave the call letters, but I'm more interested in the numbers on the dial.
Well, it's WXXI 92.7 in Madison, 92.7. Wisconsin.
Is that 92.7?
92.7 in Madison, Wisconsin.
Okay, that's on the FM dial.
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, Richard, appreciate the call.
I'll have to see if I can roll him up on the jukebox here one of these nights.
There you go. I appreciate the call. Thanks so much.
Uh-huh.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
My name is Toya. I'm a sales rep and I work for Capital Blue Cross.
If you're choosing Medicare coverage, Toya will meet you anywhere to help you decide.
I met him at food courts, diners, the parks, on a bench. And today, we're meeting at airport.
Mike was a Navy service person, an engineer, and a pilot.
I'm a senior blue PPO member.
He is technically retired.
I'm a gray-haired teenager.
Mike appreciates the visit.
It's more personal and you can talk easier. You can show emotion, which you can't over the telephone. And it's more caring.
Toya would agree.
I love my customers. I really, really do. My main objective is to show them that I care. When you care more, you do more.
For customer service, call 1-888-340-3978, Monday through Friday, 8 to 8, with extended hours October 15th through February 14th. Senior Blue PPO is issued by Capital Advantage Insurance Company, a Medicare Advantage organization with a Medicare contract. Capital Blue Cross and Capital Advantage Insurance Company are independent licensees of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
I'm David Thillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
Important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you.
The health care law, Obamacare, going to the Supreme Court?
Yes, it was pretty much inevitable because you have four appeals court rulings on this. Two of them upheld it. One threw it out. One said, well, it's too soon to rule on it. So it was something that was going to be of great interest to the Supreme, so much so they're going to devote 5.5 hours to arguments when they normally only devote about one.
Wow. Oh, I mean, this is a huge law. I mean, this is really going to, I think, going to dictate what happens in the election in 2012 because, you know, the Michelle Bachmans of the world are hoping that it stays around and that she can run on repeal. You know, if it becomes constitutional, that argument that we need to repeal it becomes even stronger, I think.
I think it does, and yet if it becomes overturned, then it galvanizes the right that, you know, we won, and if it's upheld, then it is. We must repeal. It's fascinating. The people are trying to figure out who it benefits, which way it goes. It's really impossible to tell. And, of course, the arguments are likely to be in March, which is, you know, right in the early part of the campaign, and then the decision to be handed down in June, just before the conventions, my goodness.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you know, if it is shot down, then we were back at square one, and we still have 50 million people uninsured and over 100 million people underinsured. Where do we go then?
Well, that's the issue.
I mean,
I'm not sure that anybody really knows where we go then. That's the problem.
Yeah, this is one of those moments where you go, okay, fine, which way do we go with this? But at the end of it, you still have 50 million people uninsured, 100 million underinsured, and you still have a system that now has to put the brakes on everything that it's done and revert back to the good old days of rescission and pre-existing conditions and, well, the free market dictating whether I live or die.
And everybody claims they've got a solution, but nobody's solution has been proven really to work. Yeah. And, you know, you look at some of the solutions, some of the states, and they're pretty grim.
Yeah, and you look at places like Wisconsin here in Pennsylvania, the states don't want to do this. They want no part of it. They keep cutting the state programs. They keep cutting funding for low-income people and for the poor. I got to tell you, I don't know where this goes. But it is where it belongs. It belongs in the Supreme Court, and we should have fast-tracked this earlier.
I think they wanted to see what some of the appeals courts were going to do, and now they've got four. And the good thing about having four is that you've got a lot of opinions from a lot of the different judges, and it's been really interesting to see that it has not fallen along ideological lines. The most recent ruling from the D.C. Court of Appeals, written by Judge Silverman, is a Reagan-appointed judge who was one of the ones who upheld the law.
Yeah. And then, you know, I look at that, I think it was the most recent retired justice, I think it was Breyer, who came out and said that he believes it's constitutional because of a law that he, you know, a case that he had sat on a couple of years back and he had actually written the decision for. So even he's saying, you know, this is constitutional.
It's really very interesting. And also you've got on the court Justice Roberts and Justice Alito, neither of whom have yet ruled on a case involving the Commerce Clause, so we really don't know which way they come down on it.
Yeah, see, I would think they're going to fall on the side of big business, but which side is that? Because this law guarantees the big insurers more customers.
Oh, it guarantees a lot of big business for big business.
Yeah, I was watching, kind of the same frame, I was watching some old reruns with my daughter of the Munsters, and there was, do you remember the Munsters?
Oh, very well.
Well, one of the episodes that we watched was with Paul Lynn, where his wife, he couldn't sleep, and his wife goes, are you worrying about Medicare again? And you go back to the time, and it was 1964, this episode came out, when they were debating whether they should push through with Medicare, and it's kind of interesting how that came up.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, and it just caught my attention. I was going, wow, that's just absolutely amazing. Congress doing some more things, slashing funding for the financial watchdog?
Yeah, they're slashing funding for the financial watchdog, which is going to mean that more of the reforms in the financial overhaul bill will not take place, basically, is what that's going to mean. And this is very simple. The Dodd-Frank overhaul bill. This is happening, frankly, just across the board. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, that's good, because we want the people who crashed the economy to have the exact same power they had the day before they crashed it. In fact, I want them to have more power. Which interesting
this
to
is,
me.
It's interesting that this is also happening on the same day that we're hearing that Scott Brown, the senator from Massachusetts, is coming out now apparently in favor of Richard Cordray to be head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Interesting.
Well, he wants to keep his job.
Yeah, well, he's got to move to the center, wherever that may be in Massachusetts, which is probably more left than anywhere in the country. But you know what I find amazing is I think it was Paul Ryan last week was on one of these radio talk shows, and someone asked him about Glass-Steagall. And he said, yeah, I'm in favor of going back and doing that. And you look at Dodd-Frank, nowhere near as restrictive as Glass-Steagall was. It's kind of amazing to me.
That's extraordinary.
Just, you know, I guess it may have been one of those off-the-cuff kind of, oh, yeah, you know, we need to make sure that banks are banks and hedge fund people are hedge fund people and they should never meet. And I'm going, exactly, why aren't you proposing something like that?
Maybe it's easy to say something when you know it's not going to happen.
Yeah, good point. You got something from Herman Cain? Because, you know, everybody loves Herman Cain.
Everybody loves Herman Cain. But what I have on Herman Cain has been topped now by a video that's about to go viral. What I have on Herman Cain is an interview in GQ in which he was asked about the
yes.
fuss around his previous comments about Muslims. And in this interview, he doubles down and basically says that he's talked with Muslims that are peaceful Muslims, and he's got one very well-known Muslim voice say to him directly that a majority of Muslims share the extremist views.
There you go. Yeah, all Muslims are bad.
And it's extraordinary. And the interview is very careful. He's saying, really? A majority? Yes, a majority. You think he's right? Yes, that's because that's his community. And he says, are you talking about the Muslim community in America or the world? Herman Cain says, America, America. So he's very clear. But what my story has been topped now by the emergence of an interview with, I think, Milwaukee newspaper, in which he completely flubs a question, a simple question, on Libya policy that is so embarrassing and so awkward to watch that you watch this and you're screaming at the video as you're watching it on your computer screen. You're going, I want to watch Rick Perry's Oops moment. Please let me watch that because it would be so calming.
Well, I mean, you know, at the end of this, this is what happens when you have people who really aren't up with foreign policy, with being in the political realm. This is what happens when you have rank amateurs jumping in.
I think that, you know, when you have people who really do not know the issues, it's true. Or when they haven't prepped. And the impression you get with this Libya moment, which I strongly urge you to go to Talking Points memo and look at it, you get the impression that he didn't prepare for the question.
Yeah, I mean, and there's nothing wrong, in my opinion, with saying I just don't know. I'm going to have to get back with you on it. I'm going to have to you know, ask, you know, get some information before I answer a question like that.
Yes.
But you know, for the guy who told him that he's Moses and God told him to come, you know, he should know the answer, shouldn't he?
You would think.
So we got 9 days left, huh? Before the end of the world, the next hostage situation. Nine days
for the super committee. Rapidly coming on 8 now as the evening draws in, and the super committee is supposedly no closer to making a deal, although I think it may be a little bit closer because it's thinking of doing it apparently, or at least some members are thinking of doing it in a 2-step process. And what they're thinking of doing, a few members, because the committee hasn't met since the 31st of October in total,
nice.
Is they would come up with a broad-framed agreement on tax policy. And then they would shunt it over to the congressional committees to sort out the details. But by having come up with a broad-framed agreement, they could turn around and say to everybody, see, we did it.
Yeah, they did it all right.
Yeah,
And I'm sure part of it is going to be you make all the cuts first, and we'll talk about raising taxes on the ultra-wealthy maybe in a couple years.
Well, they're going to have to come up with something very definite because Congress has to vote on this by December the 23rd. They can't shunt it too far off.
What are the chances of, and I know the president has said no way, but what are the chances of them saying, well, we couldn't come to an agreement, but the cuts to the military and the other things, just too much for us to take right now. Let's push the deadline further into next year.
I think they're going to try and find some way to finagle that.
Because Obama's come out and said he's, nope, you got to stick to your deadlines. You made the promise, you stick to it.
The only way they could do it is to create new legislation to overrule the old legislation and have him sign it. And I don't know that he'll sign it.
Especially not with the election coming up next year. Fun. I can't wait. Eight days and a couple hours.
Yeah.
Victoria Jones, always great talking with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this.
And make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in the New World. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitive child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays, were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833, and consider it is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903 when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Healy Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
I guess we now know what it is he's done before. The question is will he do it again? And, you know, like I said earlier, George Will, something I agree with. If there are four, there may be 24. The reality is we still don't know, just like the situation with Sandusky. Eight have come forward. There are eight named. Who knows? Once that floodgate opens, who knows what comes pouring out after that? And the reality is, you look at Herman and, well, I mean, he's just a gift that keeps on giving. I love Herman. For all the wrong reasons, of course, but I do. You know, the reality is he has handled this controversy probably the worst way you can, by attacking the person who is perceived as the victim in this, by telling them, well, you know what, you better think twice before anybody else comes out, or we're gonna go after you. Making fun of Pelosi, making fun of Anita Hill, probably not the best move, which kind of explains why he's fallen in the good graces of the right wing. And to me, that's kind of amazing. It tells me that somebody may be paying attention after all. Well, his wife, Gloria, went on TV as, you know, wasn't sure if it was going to happen. First it was off, then it was back on. Whole lot of things going on around here. Well, Gloria says that, you know what, he totally respects women. Absolutely. Totally. She says, I look at especially this last lady, the things that she said, and I'm thinking, he would not have split personalities and done the things that she said. Yeah, because wives know everything that their husbands do. Sure, yeah. Let me let you in a little secret. Guys think that way sometimes. If you didn't think that way, Gloria, he has, you know, two heads. Blood usually leaves the top one, a little bit down south. Just a thought. Maybe you can think about that later. My favorite today, and you know, there's a bunch of Herman Cain stuff, and I know we're not going to have time. Maybe I'll try and get to the clips. But he was interviewed by GQ magazine, and you know, just some of the weird things that come out. We had talked about one earlier today. He said, you know, hey, he was asked about pizza. And he said, you know, I like a lot of pizza, a lot of stuff on my pizza. He said, the more toppings a man has on his pizza, I believe the more manly he is. Because the more manly man, he's not afraid of abundance. And the guy asking the question says, is that purely a meat question? A manly man don't want it piled high with vegetables. He'd call that a sissy pizza. I mean, how can you not vote for this guy? A manly man piles his toppings high. And, you know, how can you not vote for a guy who says, you know, I was Moses? You know, and God called to me and said, you know, Herman, you're the guy. And, you know, so I'm Moses, just like Moses. I was called to this, he said. Does it scare you when people tell you that they've been spoken to, you know, God tells them to do things? I mean, generally we hear people say, you know, God was talking to them to go, you know, go kill dogs or go on a multi-state killing spree. Now you got this, a whole bunch of these candidates telling them that they were spoken to and that they should be running for president. Maybe, you know, I'm not trying to give God any advice. But if God wanted Herman to be president, maybe God would have said, hey, you know, don't sexually harass those four women. Maybe that voice would have come down, hey, Herman, get your hand out between her legs. Just a thought. Maybe something Herman can think about. But Herman was talking, and you gotta love this. I do want to play. I think I have a couple of minutes. You gotta listen to this. He was asked about Libya and.
Okay, Libya.
President Obama.
President Obama. Yeah.
Supported.
The
uprising.
Yeah.
Correct.
Right.
Mm-hmm. President Obama called for the removal of Gaddafi. Just want to make sure we're talking about the same thing before I say yes, I agreed. I know I didn't agree. I do not agree with the way he handled it for the following reason. No, that's a different one.
Oh, this guy wants to be president. Hold on, I'll get it.
Gotta go back. See,
go way back.
Got all this stuff twirling around in my head.
I'm sure you do.
Specifically, what are you asking me? Did I agree or not disagree with Obama?
And, you know, he's trying to, the guy asked the question, do you agree with Obama did? Which is he sent some drones over to bomb, to do a bunch of bombing. He wanted Gaddafi out, said he had to go. Now, the easy answer is what I said. I'm against sending troops into Libya. If you're going to support the UN action, you're going to support other countries taking the lead, I'm okay with that. We need to make sure that, you know, that Gaddafi, who was a bad guy, goes. I'm in favor of that. Have some kind of a democratic uprising, not a bad idea. He can't do that. What he's looking for that answer going, now I know Obama was for it. Or maybe he wasn't. Hold on. Because whatever Obama did, I got to do the opposite. And he goes on. I mean, it's just brilliant.
Here's what I would have. I would have done a better job of determining who the opposition is.
Oh.
And I'm sure that our intelligence people had some of that information.
Uh-huh.
Based upon who made up that opposition, okay, based upon who made up that opposition, might have caused me to make some different decisions about how we participated. Secondly, no, I did not agree with Gaddafi killing its citizens. Absolutely not. So something would have had to been, I would have supported many of the things that they did in order to help stop that. It's not a simple yes-no, because there are different pieces, and I would have gone about assessing the situation differently, which might have caused us to end up in the same place.
Oh.
But where I think more could have been done was, what's the nature of the opposition?
He's really trying to separate himself without just saying, look, you know, you did a good job. Pat on the back. Good for you. He's reaching, and he really, someone told him something that he may remember. He's really digging. It's kind of interesting.
So you would have sent ground troops, or?
I did. I said I would have done a better job of assessing the situation relative to the opposition first before I made those decisions about what we would do.
So many Republicans supported, congratulated him for how he handled that. You would not have been among that group?
I'm not criticizing him. I'm just saying I just don't think enough was done relative to assessing the opposition before everything, you know, exploded. That's what I'm saying.
And again, I ask the question, how does he know? How does he know what Obama knew and what the CIA or what the intelligence people presented to him? How does he know that? But he knows he would assess it differently, because he would be a more deliberate decision maker.
I'm a much more deliberate decision maker. Uh-huh. It's a point that I'm I keep coming back to. Some people want to say, well, as president, you're supposed to know everything. No, you don't. I believe in having all of the information, as much of it as I possibly can, rather than making a decision or making a statement about whether I totally agreed and didn't agree when I wasn't privy to the entire situation. There might be some things there that might have caused me to feel differently. So I'm not trying to hedge on the questions. It's just that that's my nature as a businessman. I need to know the facts as much as possible. I need to hear all of the alternatives.
Unlike Obama, who just, you know, woke up in the middle of the night and said, let's bomb them. That's a good idea. I don't care about any information. I'm just going to do it. I mean, the whole point of this thing is he's trying to figure out a way to make Obama look bad while propping up his own whatever skill he may have, while not actually understanding the process. And he finally says this, which kind of wraps it all up.
For example,
gotta love the mouth.
You might have mentioned that even within the administration, there were different views. I would want to hear all those views, look at all the information, and then I make the decision as the commanding chief. So this is the only point I'm trying to make.
So I'm not clear then. What were the parts that you're criticizing the president for of how he handled it?
Okay. The opposition that wanted to overthrow Gaddafi. Who are they?
Crickets.
How organized are they? How strong are they? Who would be the parent leader? Now that they have succeeded, did they have a plan for how they were going to govern? Or are you going to end up now with a country in complete chaos? This is what I mean by...
But if they didn't have that, then would you back off and not and gotten involved?
It would depend upon which part they didn't have.
There you go.
So what I'm saying is it's not a clear yes-no answer, because all of those things I think should have been assessed. That's what I'm saying.
And of course,
you don't think they were assessed.
I don't know that they were or were not assessed.
First honest answer.
I didn't see reports of that assessment.
Together, we can.
We'll see you tomorrow night. I love Herman. Thank you. Have a great night.
Or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's color like the tide of flood beneath the blur sway. Imperial, mysterious, in amorous array. Democracy is coming to the U.S.A.
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Good memories are for